This is the Preparedness Radio Network, preparing you for natural and man-made disasters, helpful tips on gardening and homesteading. Be prepared and remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.
It's the 21st century, a dangerous world. Preppers need food and medicine. Why not have the best? Enterfood.com does the shopping, prep, and packaging for you using the best organic ingredients on the planet. Right now, specials are available for listeners of this station. The all-organic vegetarian food storage pail and the herbal medicine cabinet. The pail holds up to 120 flavorful meals, super packed fresh to last up to 15 years, soaked, cooked, or raw. The herbal medicine cabinet holds everything you'll need to cure common ailments. Use these items in an emergency or use them when camping. You can't beat these prices. Call to order now, 866-762-9238, 866-762-9238, or go to enterfood.com. That's E-N-E-R-F-O-O-D.com, enterfood.com.
Hey, meat eaters, the freeze-dried guy wants to know, does your emergency food supply meet the standards for survival? Then get the 144-day meat variety unit from the freeze-dried guy. Our meat units utilize only quality Mountain House freeze-dried cooked ground chicken and ground beef, the undisputed choice for great taste and highest nutrition. The freeze-dried guy's 144-day meat variety unit includes six number 10 cans of the very best freeze-dried animal protein for power you'll need when the going gets tough. Every meat eater's 144-day meat variety unit comes with a free medical kit and always free shipping to the lower 48. Need more than 144 days? See our one-year-plus meat eater's units at freezedryguy.com. And hey, the freeze-dry guy still has LRP rations, but they're going fast. Don't wait until tomorrow. Call now, 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-3663. Or go to freezedryguy.com and meet the standards for survival.
BHM Radio is on the air on the Preparedness Radio Network. BHM Radio is the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine, expanding the stories you love in print live across the net. And now, your hosts for BHM Radio, Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci.
Hey, hey, hey. Good morning to you all out there. This is Bubba Da Vinci. We're coming to you live from Springdale, Arkansas this week. Colorado Ron and I decided to hit the road, and we've been driving for the last 3 days. And he'll be popping on here in about 5 minutes, unless I don't believe he's already on. He'll be calling live from his cell phone. We are at the Popular Mechanics Show in Springdale, Arkansas. It's been a real exciting week. We decided, I guess, on Tuesday of this week that Colorado Ron and I would meet up. He would fly into Kansas City, and we'd rent a car, and we've been looking at doing an East Coast event, and we decided that we were going to drive to the East Coast and start looking at venues. And it's been a kind of an exciting adventure, driving for the 18 hours and making stops as we cross the country, checking out places and doing things. And after doing that and actually finding potentially two venues, which we'll hopefully announce next week, we turned around and we drove all the way back to Arkansas, another 18-hour drive through everything else, and came here to meet up with Lisa Bedford, Survivor Mom, and Doc Bones and Nurse Amy, and James T. Stevens, who is Dr. Prepper. I mean, they're all here. It's a fantastic show. If anybody's out here in the Arkansas area, you can get out there. It starts at 11 o'clock this morning, and it's being held at the Holiday Inn Convention Center here in Springdale. So, exciting weekend this weekend. We typically only have two guests, and this week we're grabbing in three. Here in about 10 minutes, we will have Jackie Clay. Jackie Clay is a contributor to Backwoods Home Magazine, and she is also an author of several books, and she is going to be one of our panel speakers, and we're going to talk about that here in a few minutes, at the May Self-Reliance Expo. And, you know, she's an amazing woman. We actually had her on our first show when we were doing Fridays. And, you know, you can't get enough time with these people. Her story is so amazing. And hopefully we'll cover a little bit more of that and talk about what she's doing. She has some interesting things coming up. And then on the during the 8 o'clock hour, we will have the producer of Doomsday Preppers from National Geographic. It's Alan Madison, and he is he's a producer over at Shark Entertainment. And we've been talking to Alan for a while and his staff over there, and they participated in several events last year. And some of his cast, his casting from last year, happened at our events. So we're actually very honored to have Alan jump on the phone with us and spend a few minutes talking about what's going on with Doomsday Preppers and what's going on with the future. And then last, totally excited about this. And Colorado Ron and I were talking about this yesterday as we were driving up. Mad Mike, last week we gave him a challenge. And we said, we had talked about the Fukushima incident and how we were at the anniversary and how they had just had an earthquake. Almost on their anniversary. And we had said, you know, people, you know, say, well, that's over in Japan, and, you know, how much we really have to be concerned about radiation other than, you know, nuclear attack and blah, blah, blah. And we said, okay, Fukushima had nothing to do with terrorists. It had nothing to do with nuclear attacks. Fukushima was 100% about a natural disaster happening and putting people at risk because of the proximity of the populace around a nuclear reactor and the damage that was done. And so the question came out, how many reactors are here in the United States that are actually positioned in areas that have reoccurring natural disasters and could put people at risk? And, you know, I was shocked at the information that he had, including he did a fantastic, he sent us a map that shows, you know, where these reactors are and the potential radius of the potential damage they could have according to natural disasters. And I was shocked at where some of these were. I mean, if you were to give me 10 pins or 20 pins and say stick them in the map where you think that there's danger zones, I would have been maybe 20% right. So very, very excited to get this up on our blog and up on our Facebook page and show the information and, you know, get some discussions going with Mad Mike and with the audience to kind of talk about what's going on. So that will be our third guest, Mad Mike from RadWatch. So again, excuse me, a pretty filled day for this show. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it goes all the way through. Now, I do have to give you guys a warning. We will be, like I said, Colorado Ron will be calling in from his cell phone, and I'm out here and I'm talking via Skype in a hotel room. And so there's always the possibility that we will drop as we go through there, or the sound quality may be bad. So if that happens, please let us know, and we will do our best to go ahead and make adjustments and pop on real quick and go from there. So hopefully everything will end up working out and we'll be able to move forward. I hate to go through all this stuff without Colorado Ron on the line because it seems like I'm taking away from some of his glory. But we've been Facebooking as we've gone through. And one of the things that Colorado Ron wanted to do as part of this trip was he watches this show called, I think it's Dives, Diners, and Drive-Ins. And I might be misquoting it. Please forgive me if I am. But as part of that, you know, you go and you look up the area, and apparently this guy travels across the United States and finds places and says, this is a good food, and this is, you know, this is outstanding at this little dive or diner or drive-in or whatever it is. And we went to several of them. And I'll tell you what, this was pretty right on. For I want to go and do that. I will. how good could it matter? You know, you never know where you're going to be when you go to these places. And you do things. I've seen those on
Scott
TV.
Scott, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're breaking up pretty bad. Could we take a quick early commercial and you call back in, please?
That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Looking for power grid independence? The Humless Solar Kit is the answer. Increasing brownouts in the U.S. suggest it's time to get a backup. The problem is gas generators are messy, require maintenance, and oh, gas, which may be scarce in a real emergency. Get the Humless Solar Kit by itself or with a 1,000-watt Humless Sentinel generator. The kit includes a 100-watt solar panel, 20-foot extension cord, LED floodlight, rechargeable flashlights, and more. Become a fan at Humless.com or on Facebook. Thanks for listening to a word from our sponsors. Now, back to the show on the Preparedness Radio Network.
Welcome back to Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed. This is Bubba DaVinci, and we apologize. We told you that being on the road will definitely add some technical difficulties, so hopefully we'll be able to continue on. We won't have many more interruptions like that. As I was saying, we've had some challenges on the road. Hopefully when Colorado Ron and I comes back, we'll go ahead and talk about that. But we have Jackie Clay on now. Jackie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm just fine.
So how is the weather up in the north?
Well, today it's cloudy and drizzly, but drizzly is good because we've been in drought and everything is really, really dry. So we're real glad to see the rain.
Well, good. You know, we're happy to have you back. We talked to you about a month and a half ago on our first show, and we just got started getting into the questions, and that little annoying Tweety Bird popped up and said it was time for us to log off. So thank you for coming back.
Glad to be here.
So, we haven't completely announced everything that we're doing at the next show in May, but you have agreed to come out and be part of a panel session in May at the Colorado Springs event, and you'll be on a panel with four other women. And we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Now you do quite a few panel sessions, don't you? You've traveled around and done book signings and done speaking sessions before, correct?
Yes, I have.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I try not to do it too often because I'm a homesteader first, a writer second, and then I speak when I have a little time.
Well, and I'm sure since you guys do everything yourself up there at your property, that probably isn't very often.
No, we're getting a little teeny bit more spare time now. You know, we've been on the land here for quite a few years, and things are finally starting to get a little under control, and that's why we're going to do our first homesteading seminar. We've been asked to do it a lot before, but we just have not had the time. You wouldn't think 3 days would make a big difference in the summer, but sometimes, oh, yes, it does.
Yeah, well, and thank you. That was a great segue. One of the things we wanted to talk to you about in our last interview with you, you had mentioned that you were going to be doing these classes, but we didn't get a lot of time to get information from you because we were running out of time. So can you tell us, I'm pretty excited about this, the weekend after our event, which our event's May 18th and 19th, you're having people come to your home and actually taking the classes there on your property. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is. Yeah, that'd be the 25th, 26th, and 27th of May. And we're running real intensive hands-on three-day classes, and we're limiting the number to only 20 people so that we can give them a real personal experience, not just the 120 people in the audience that never get a chance to ask the questions that they're burning to ask, you know, things that are really important to them because there's just too many people. With just a few people, everybody can ask any question they want, and we'll try to answer it.
Now, is this 3 days, is it all inclusive? Are they staying on your property? Are they staying near it? And what time do you start? What time do you stop?
We're running them basically 9 to 5, and I'm sure that the 5 o'clock cutoff isn't going to happen. But some people will be camping here on our property. Some people will be staying at a friend that has a bed and breakfast that's only 2 miles from us. Some are going to camp on National Forest by the lakes. And some are going for more civilized accommodations at motels and resorts nearby. Well, not real nearby. To us, nearby. So, you know, everybody's going to meet here about 9 o'clock in the morning, and we're going to go from there.
Can you give us a little bit of a sample of the kind of things that you kind of have pre-planned?
Yeah, and this is just kind of a loose outline because we'll cover these topics and I'm sure a million more. But basically, we're going to do heirloom seed selection and tell everybody where they can get seeds at a good price. Seed starting, saving your own seeds so that next year you don't have to buy seeds. Ways to extend your growing season. We use wall water plant protectors and cold frames and roll hoops, and we also have built a hoop house for our peppers last year, and it dramatically increased our production. We went from just enough peppers to have for salsa and spaghetti sauce to bushels of peppers in the same amount of ground, and the only thing we did different was just a real simple, cheap plastic hoop house. And we're going to actually build a hoop house from the get-go. So that'll be part of it. Establishing a homestead orchard and places that you can get trees that are hardy in cold climates. Establishing a berry patch and places to get berry bushes that are going to grow for you. Chickens, incubating eggs, raising chicks. The homestead dairy, we're going to talk about dairy goats, we're going to talk about dairy cows, how to milk, how to make cheese, simple cheese, and living off the grid on a limited budget. Anybody can live off the grid if they have thousands and thousands of dollars, but we've done it on a very slim shoestring, and it's working fine for us. So those are just some of the things we're going to talk about in those 3 days.
Well, I mean, I was just writing down some of this list, and it's—I can't believe that you're going to get all that stuff done in 3 days. I mean, each one of those topics, it seems like probably can take up, you know, the 3 days all by themselves.
There's two of us, and we talk fast. And like I said, this is going to be, you know, a hands-on thing. We're going to go right around the homestead, and we're going to really get into it.
Wow. I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
We want to make sure that people get their money's worth and then some. We want to change people's lives, the way they look at everything.
Well, and I definitely think that would. You know, I'm looking at the dates, and I'm trying to figure out now, we're bringing you down, and then you're heading back up there, so you'll have like a week to, you know, 4 or 5 days to get prepared before that show. Unfortunately, I'm trying to figure out how I drive back from Colorado Springs in time to make it to that, because almost everything you have here are things that I, as a complete novice, am experiencing right now. I mean, I'll be honest, I have no clue what a hoop house is. But
it's PVC pipes that are just framed in a hoop with plastic stretched over them. Very simple.
Oh, okay. But we've been looking at trying to figure out what trees would be good for us up in Iowa, fruit trees. And, you know, we actually, I don't know if you saw it on Facebook, but I built my, we had a built, our first chicken coop built. And this thing is like, it looks like a tank. I mean, considering we're going to have, you know, the lessons I'm learning are that I don't, not everything that I get doesn't necessarily have to be built to the nth degree. we're probably overdoing things. But, we're doing chickens, and my wife and I have definitely been talking about trying to figure out the dairy thing. Although I really want a cow. I know goats are easier to do it. It's the visions of grandeur and putting on your, being the green farmer and walking around with my overalls and my hat and walking out there and seeing Betsy out in the field. You know, that just seems really cool. But
it is.
I know that's not ideal.
We've got a cow and we've got dairy goats, so each one of them is perfect for some instances. You know, the cow gives us way more manure and a lot more milk, too. But, you know, we love our goats, and they're so easy to handle, and they sure give, you know, each one of them gives us 3 quarts or a gallon of milk a day, so that's lots of milk, too. Some people really don't need 6 gallons of milk a day.
Well, and I was just going to ask that. We have actually, in a second, I'm going to ask a question. We have a question from our chat room, so I'll get to that in 1 second, guys. But I have to ask you, the scariest thing and the thing my wife points out all the time as we do this is, you know, do we really need blank? So it's like you build a chicken coop, and do we need 12 chickens? Can we really eat that many eggs? Or do you need a cow? You know, are our daughters and my wife and I going to be able to drink that much milk, or can we convert enough of it into a cheese, and we really need that much cheese? I mean, how do you balance, you know, and what do you do with the excess as a homesteader as you've gone through this? I mean, how do you look at things like that?
There is no excess. On a true established homestead, this is when you get it up and going. When you're first starting, it isn't up and running homestead. It's just in the stages, you know, the building stages. But once you get it up and running, it's like a circle. With our goats and our cows, if we have extra milk, we feed some of it to the babies, you know, the calves and the kid goats. Okay, some of it we drink, obviously. I make cheese, and I don't just make cheese. I make several soft cheeses that are basically like cream cheese. So we use those in baking and, you know, mixing to make spread for crackers and everything. I make hard cheeses. I make mozzarella and ricotta from the whey. Anything that's left over, I mean, there's ice cream, there's butter. You know, when you think of all of the dairy products that you have, that you would buy at the store, it's amazing that milk goes awfully fast when you're making all these things. If you have anything left over, we also raise pigs, not a lot of pigs, because if you have too many, then it gets expensive. But we raise enough that we can butcher and then sell a couple. And those pigs love the milk. They love the extra whey. And we also give some of it to our chickens because it's a really good protein source. So we mix that in with our dry chicken feed so we can get by with buying less chicken feed. So that saves money. So it all runs in a circle because, like, the extra chicken eggs that I don't sell or don't trade away or we don't use, a lot of them, in the summertime, I pickle them. I'm doing that right now. I'm making pickled eggs, and they're awesome for deviled eggs and egg salad sandwiches in the winter when the chickens aren't laying too much. So if we have extra eggs, the pigs get it. And it all goes in a big circle. And all that manure goes right on the garden or on our fields and makes our food for the animals and food for us.
So realistically, it's about balance. You know, it's getting started, and initially it might be difficult because not, like you said, working on a budget, not everybody can get everything at one time. But once you've got it established, it just kind of balances itself out, and one thing kind of helps another.
It does. That's the way it needs to work. And the reason most people fail at modern homesteading is wanting to do everything at once. And they'll go out and charge everything on their credit card, and they'll buy a whole bunch of animals and a whole bunch of equipment, and they don't have the facilities, the experience, and then pretty soon it's overwhelming. And they go broke, they're discouraged, and they go back to the city and say, the heck with that.
Well,
and I just hate to have that happen. I hate it.
If my wife or my family is listening, you've almost described me, with the exception of the credit card. You know, I'm not extreme, but you know, paying cash for everything. But it is discouraging. I mean, I want everything now. Yeah, you know? And we always joke around. It's a now society. Everybody wants instant gratification.
It is. It really is. So you know, we're trying to encourage people to go a little slower and have fun doing it. You know, a little slower doesn't take all that much longer, but it's really, really necessary so you don't have homestead burnout.
Right, right. Well, honey, if you're listening, I promise I'll try to go slower. So please forgive me. I'm learning
from
Jackie.
That's not possible.
Oh, okay. Colorado Ron just joined the call, and it's a perfect time. Just enough time for him to go ahead and make sure. See, Colorado Ron has patience. I mean, obviously, he just spent 18 hours in the car with me. He's got patience. But, yeah, but he knows that I have none. It's like even when we're driving down the road and I see a gas station, it's like, okay, we're going right now. Everything's got to be instant for me, and that's a horrible thing. So hopefully you'll be able to teach some of those patients, Jackie. I would assume that the people that are coming to your class are open-minded about those sorts of things. They're coming to you at this stage because they've hit a wall, or they're at that level where they just need a little bit more knowledge, and they're hoping to get that. But they're open to what you're going to be giving them.
Well, I hope so. But people are people. Some people are more open than others, you know. And we can just but hope that we're going to help.
Right. Well, before I keep going with this, I want to make sure that I get this chat room question in, so that way people don't say we ignore them in the chat room. We have a question that says, Jackie, our family is looking to change our lifestyles from the city to the country. As a beginning prepper with canning experience, what should we start with first to begin our prepping storage?
Definitely a garden. Get a garden started. Get a few fruit trees in, maybe just three or four, but get some trees in. Get a garden worked up. That's your number one thing. After that, I'd say chickens. You know, try to get some chickens because they provide you with not only meat but eggs too. And once you start with those, that gives you a little experience. Chickens don't require a huge outlay as far as building, fencing. They're easy to keep home. They don't run away. They don't stample on you. So most people get along with chickens excellent, you know. And not too big a garden because you want it to produce. If you make a big, huge garden at first, it's going to end up all weeds and you're going to get discouraged. So a moderate garden and really work it up well.
Okay, and you know, well, they're saying they're moving from the city to the country. It wasn't part of their question, but I'm kind of wondering how much property does a person really need to kind of get started? I know Colorado Ron lives in a suburb, and he's in an urban area, so that way that's constrained. But if I'm moving from the city, if Colorado Ron says I'm chucking it to the wind and I'm moving out to the country, what's a good starter size? I mean, again, when I moved up, I kept telling my wife, I want 100 acres, I want 200 acres. And she kind of laughed and she said, what would you do with that? You know, you don't even know what you're starting with. What are you going to do with that much property? What's a good starter? I mean, like if I was going to do it from square one and I said, I want to start at the minimum, you know, what's a good starting size?
Well, that depends on the person and the area they're moving into. I'll give you a for instance. If you're in Missouri, there's a lot of places you can graze a cow year-round on an acre of ground. The grass grows year-round. It's wonderful. Then you move to New Mexico, and I've been in places in New Mexico where it took 100 acres to graze one cow just during the summer because the grass would mature and it wouldn't keep growing because it was too dry. So it depends a lot on your area. If you're like midstream there where it's not perfect growing and it's not dry, you know, I'd say buy as much land as you can because you're never going to have too much land, but sometimes you go, oh, gosh, if we only had some more land, we could have beef cattle or we could have a bigger pasture or whatever. But a lot of people are very productive on 5 acres, you know, and I would kind of, if you're really aiming towards self-reliance, I think I'd hold out on the 5 acres. Of course, there's a lot of people that have done it on a lot less land. We have people that have a 100-by-200-foot lot in town, and they have rabbits, they have chickens, they grow nearly all their own food, but they garden very, very intensively, and it's very nice land, you know, deep soil, and they don't have any climate problems. So it, you know, that's sort of like asking how long is a string.
How long is a string?
Smack you, Jack. Good, smack you.
Too far away.
That actually is a very good point. I can completely see how it's dependent on, because you know you're right. In Texas, with things so dry, you need tens of acres to go ahead and feed out one cow.
Yeah.
And so that's very, very common, and you know that makes a lot of sense. And I guess it also depends on your budget, right? Because one of the keys that I'm learning, and it's a hard lesson to learn, is don't overspend. You know, don't, just because you can get something doesn't mean you should get something.
Yeah.
Would you agree
exactly
with that?
Yeah, exactly. And it depends on how much pioneering spirit you have. A lot of times you can buy a fixer-upper house on 40 acres for the same amount of money that you could buy a nice three-bedroom home that's top of the line, you know, with 3 acres or something. So it depends on how much. We bought 80 acres here, and there wasn't anything on it. There was popple trees and brush and stumps. So, you know, we had to build a house. We had to do our clearing and our fencing. It depends on how much get up and go you've got. You can buy bare land a lot cheaper than you can buy a house on 2 acres, you know, when it's a nice house. So, you know, it depends on how much you want to work, you know, or can work. Some people just can't.
Right. I think I definitely have the spirit, but the pioneer knowledge is lacking here. Colorado Ron is a little bit different.
Jackie, did he tell you about his chicken coop?
Yeah.
Oh, he said it was built like a tank. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. For two chickens.
Oh, leave me alone! Leave me alone.
Some friends that their chicken coop is varnished on the inside, and they sweep it out every day. And I went, oh, my God, my chickens are going to call 911 chicken abuse, you know.
So are you going to give the people any opportunity to actually work with your animals? I mean, you said it's going to be hands-on, but is it more hands-on in the garden, setting up, like, the hoopering? Or, like, how do you milk a goat? I mean, do you hand-milk a goat, or do you use, like, a device?
No, we hand milk, and yes, people will be able to get right in there if they want to try milking a cow. You know, we're going to certainly have some opportunities for that.
I mean, I've watched Green Acres, and I've seen them milk cows.
They're acres. Those cows aren't really milked.
I'm embarrassed. say this, but I don't think I've ever actually seen, I mean, even when you go to the fairs, you know, they typically are just, you know, sticking those machines on them, and then they, you see the milk getting sucked down and everything else. I can't imagine. It seems like it would be awfully difficult. I mean, in the movies, they always show them doing it, and, you know, squirting themselves in the eye and everything else. Is it difficult to train an animal to stand to, so you can go ahead and do that? I mean, I'd hate somebody pulling on me to get something out of me.
And no, we feed them when they're being milked, and they could care less. It's a relief to them. They're glad to be milked. They're not, like, fighting you.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm sure people in the chat room are going, get this guy off the show. Get Colorado Ron a new host because this guy's an idiot. So that's okay, guys, because remember, I'm the newbie. I'm making the mistakes, so you don't have to. So
that's why we're giving these classes, so these people don't have to make the mistakes that we've made when we were young.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. Okay, I've got another question that pops up. It's Lenita Campbell Slayton asked, where do you begin looking for land at a good price? And that's a great question because, you know, yeah, I don't, where did you come from, Jackie, initially? When you bought your property, you know, were you already in the Minnesota area or did you guys come from someplace else?
Well, I'll tell you, we came from Montana, but we also, before that, had a homestead in New Mexico. And I was born in Detroit, Michigan, by the way. So, you know, there are hopes for people that are city people.
Wow,
but
really?
Yeah. But to getting back to her question, part of it depends on what you like. There's no sense in saying, well, I'm going to go to Alaska and not be able to handle the weather, not be able to handle bugs, not be able to handle isolation. Maybe you've got family in Missouri. You know, that would be a good place. Maybe you have family in Minnesota. You know, that would be a good place. There's a lot of relatively inexpensive land. There is no cheap land anymore. There is no homestead land anymore. Is in, you go live on the land for 5 years and improve it and you get it for free or very cheap. That just does not happen anymore. But some of the areas that there are cheaper land, you know, upstate New York, Vermont, Maine, northern Minnesota, some parts of Wisconsin, but taxes are really high there. Some of the states, you know, like Nebraska, Texas, Oklahoma have some areas of cheaper land. But there again, you've got to kind of watch it. You know, is there enough water? That's your big concern there.
Yeah, and I guess your other concern, I'm sorry, go ahead, Paula.
I was going to just say, it's a good idea to check the zoning regulations in an area that you want to move in, because some places the building codes are so strict that if you build an outhouse or a chicken coop, you've got to have a building inspector and, you know, terrible constraints like that that are really hard to live with. So check out your zoning regulations before you sign on the dotted line.
Yeah, and I guess it would also depend on what you're doing with the property, right? I mean, if you're talking about completely leaving the city and moving up out into the country and that's going, and you're full-time living on a homestead, you kind of have to ask your the question, you know, what things are you going to need access to on a regular basis? How easy is it to get there? You know, if are you working on the property or do you have to get to work or you have to telecommute, and how easy is it to get the things that you need to do your job? I would assume all those are factors.
Yeah, especially the job thing, because no matter where you go, you're going to have some source of a cash income. And, you know, some homesteaders have made it really good by developing a homestead business of some sort. Some develop a market garden. Some do online business, but there has to be some source of cash income unless you're going to live a life of real privation, and not many modern people want to do that. So the job thing is real important.
Well, and it's an interesting thing you say that. Another one of our writers for Backwoods Home Magazine will be co-chairing the panel with Jackie, and that's Patrice Lewis. And the topic that she'll actually be covering is homeschooling and home businesses. You know, because she's also someone that went out and then started a home business to offset her costs for the homesteading that they did. Her and her husband.
Yeah, and they were real successful. But the thing to remember is any homestead business that you get into is going to take a little setup cash, and it's going to take a little while to develop your business, just like anywhere else. You don't just go, bam, I'm going to sell candles, and all of a sudden you're making enough to pay the taxes, you know, insurance, whatever. It takes a little startup cash, and it takes a little while to get known and to develop your markets.
Right. I have one other question that's popped up inside the chat room. It says, and this is a good one for Jackie, are your classes full? Can they still register and where, and how much are they? And think about this, Jackie. You've already got one more spot full because I'm coming. So whatever you say, reduce it by one.
Yes, we had one cancellation just yesterday, and we had four spots. So the cancellation can be replaced with you.
Yay.
And we have four more spots left. And all you have to do is email me through the magazine, and that's just Jackie@backwoodshome.com. And if you don't get through there, go to the blog and then just click on the Ask Jackie a Question. Call the magazine if you need to. And to lock down a spot, you just need to send a $100 deposit, and your spot will be reserved. The total fee is $400 per person, or $350 each for two or more people coming together.
Wow, that's
and included. Included in that, you get an autographed copy of either one of my books, Growing and Canning Your Own Food, or Jackie Clay's Pantry Cookbook. So, and then you'll get one meal a day and a weenie roast on Saturday night.
And this basically runs Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
No, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Actually, I'm looking at my notes, and I wrote I needed to leave for your place on the 24th, so I was including the 24th in my date. Forgive me, 25th, 26th, and 27th. And that's actually very reasonable considering the amount of time, hands-on time, and knowledge that you're giving to each person. I mean, I've sat in on different sorts of sessions that you do in big groups that are a lot more expensive than that, so it's wonderful.
Yeah, well, like I said, and we're going to basically run 9 to 5, but that 5 o'clock probably is going to get stretched. And then on Saturday night in the evening, we're going to have a bonfire and a weenie roast, and people can interchange with each other and also pick our brains for all they're worth. So we're going to have a little extra session there for those who want it.
So how long have you been on your 80 acres now? Jackie?
We moved here in 2003.
Okay. So now here's the question that popped up when we were talking to you last time. You know, because somebody had said that they had thought you'd been there for almost 8 years, and it sounds like it's more almost 10. You know, is your property where you want it to be? You know, and this is one of those age-old questions. Anything I've ever done, it's never good enough, and so it's always evolving. You know, I'm sure there's always work on a homestead, but when you moved up there in 2003 and you had a vision in your head, has it gotten to the point where you're like, wow, this is close to what I wanted? Do you feel like you've achieved your vision in that period of time?
Oh, it's getting there. There's still a lot we want to do. We bought the 40 acres next to us last spring, and my husband Will's busy clearing some of that. He's got it pretty near fenced for livestock pasture, but we're building a barn this year. He built a big storage shed 2 years ago, and, you know, we've developed our orchard and our berry patch, and our garden's a lot bigger. We've got a spring catchment basin that's developed so we can irrigate everything all at one crack. We just pull a gas pump starter rope, and we've got like 10, 12 sprinklers all going at one time. So we're doing daily things that make every day's work less. You know, we're not getting any younger, and we'd like it in another 5 or 10 years to really be easy to work with and meet all of our needs.
Where have you gotten your knowledge from? I mean, we're getting it from you. I mean, and you grew up in Detroit, of all places. You know, so it's not like you said, well, I grew up in the country, in the mountains, and my family was doing this the entire time. How did you acquire these skills? For those of us who are just getting started, you know, how long did it take, or was it just natural and it was very easy progression for you?
Actually, some of it was my grandmother and my mother both grew up on farms, and even when I was little, in Detroit, my grandmother had two lots in the city, and she grew a lot of our own food. She had fruit trees, berry bushes. Where people had barberries, she would have a row of raspberries. I remember canning down in the basement, canning peaches and you know, all kinds of garden produce right down in the basement. From when I was really little, that's some of my best memories. And I think my second word was compost pile. So, my grandmother, I think to get rid of me, she'd say, here, go put this in the compost pile, you know, so I'd trot over and put it in the compost pile, you know, so I'd be gotten rid of for a while. So, but, and my mother was very interested in foraging wild foods, and my dad was a big outdoorsman, you know, so when I was tiny, I mean, we're 2 and 3 years old. I've got pictures of us camping in a wilderness in an army pup tent, you know. So I kind of grew up that way, but still living in Detroit. But, like, we'd take off for a weekend and, you know, we'd be gone a lot from Detroit.
Wow.
And then when I got my first homestead was when I graduated from high school. I rented with my rent being worked off is fixing up a really rat hole of a house. And so it went from there. I learned about goats and cows, and it went on. Life's a progression, so is homesteading.
Well, I mean, it would be great. I mean, I have to admit, and I don't know what Colorado Ron's experience was, you know, I had the opportunity to learn a lot of this stuff from my grandfather. And, you know, when you're young, you don't pay attention and you think you know it all. And, you know, I'm dealing with that with my daughters now, and it's a sad state. So I didn't take the time to learn these things, and now I'm struggling to do it now. So anybody young out there that still have a chance to learn these things, pay attention. But if not, go to Jackie's class. but you know, it's difficult nowadays because everything is made for you. You can pretty much buy anything you need, and you're not getting that hands-on experience or seeing things the way they actually should be done. You're reading about it, and then most people don't have the opportunity to actually do it. So I still feel like something's lost. You know,
I'm really concerned because I feel like there's a whole generation, and we're working on the next generation, that have totally lost these skills. And these are truly survival skills, you know, being able to grow your own food, build your own shelter, you know, doing it for yourself. You never know what the future might come. My grandmother was widowed when she was only 30 years old, and that was before welfare, food stamps, anything like that. So she had to make her way. you know, my mother and my dad went through the Depression. My mother was on a really remote homestead in Montana, and then they moved by horse and wagon to Canada to try to do better. So, you know, they had it really, really tough back then. And, you know, times have been so good for so long that a whole generation has lost these skills because it's so easy to go to the store and buy this, buy that, and they've never had to do it. And it's really sad that true survival skills that are so basic have been lost.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Even people that are coming back from, people like myself say, oh, well, I was in the military, I've learned this, I've learned that, and I realize that the skills that you learn are truly so basic and have very little practical application in your everyday life, just living everyday life in a you know, homesteading or self-reliant way. I mean, it gives you a starting block, but it's no, you know, we don't do it often enough to really have a good knowledge. And so much is just completely lost.
Yeah, and, the next generation, all the cyber knowledge that's out there is stunning. I mean, I just learned to Skype yesterday. That was, it was like, oh, my God, I've got to get this webcam, and I've got to, because my boss, Dave Duffy at the magazine, wanted to do Skype interviews with me on the computer, and I'm going, oh, my God. So I spent all day yesterday and beat my head on the floor a little bit, and, his son, Sam, is very, very good with all this cyber knowledge, and so he was walking me through it, and his sister, Annie, got on there, and we got it all working. But, to me, knowledge like that is okay, but it doesn't put food on your table.
Yeah, well, I agree. So here's the deal. We know Dave, Dave's a good friend, and we always like sitting down and talking to him. And Sam is actually pulling, I think, Dave along by his shirt collar also, to get him up in speed. But the more he plays with it, the more I think he likes it. So here's my deal for you. Is if you make sure by the time I leave my class, I've got a good recipe for pickled eggs, because Colorado Ron and I love pickled eggs.
Oh, yeah, I got to have some pickled eggs.
I will spend a little bit of time with you in the evenings and help you on the technical side with anything that you have questions on. And leave you with a bunch of notes, hands on.
That's a deal.
So, Colorado Ron, next road trip, pickled eggs. Woo-hoo.
That's right. Woo-hoo.
Jackie Clay style. All right, well, we're coming up to the end of the hour, Jackie. I wanted to go ahead and thank you again for coming on the show. I wanted to get I'm very excited about the class you have. I do have another question that's popped up, which is payment for your class. Once they email you, do you accept PayPal, or what methods do you accept for the payment of the class?
I'm not set up to do PayPal. Like I said, I'm very cyber ignorant. I'm sure down the road I may do it, but, a personal check, a money order, not cash, I don't trust the mail, but a check, a money order, that'll work just fine.
Okay, so they email you, you'll reply, give them the information on where they can send it and confirm their class. They send you $100 via mail, via check or cashier's check. That locks down their spot, and they can pay the remaining balance when they come up there.
Exactly.
See, guys, it's not that difficult, and, I know it's not the way it typically gets done anymore, but that's the whole thing, is you're getting a little retro here,
Yeah, you got to do a little bit of snail mail, this is homesteading here.
Well, and people, I'm sure there's people out there going, is there really mail anymore? I mean, it's like, how do I put the check in my computer? Yeah, it's funny because we went someplace recently, and I didn't know what to, actually, this is just a quick story, Jackie. Yesterday, Colorado and Ron and I were driving from North Carolina back here to Arkansas for this show. And I pull into a gas station, and I go to get gas, and they don't take cards in the gas pump. So I'm like, okay, I'll go inside.
And
I go inside, and I pull out the card, and I said, here, can you do this? And he goes, I don't take cards. It's cash only. I stopped and stared at the guy probably for 30 seconds because I was like, who pays cash anymore? I mean, it's amazing how simple something like that is, and we completely, again, instant society, you completely forget how we used to transact things by shaking hands, sending handwritten letters, and paying things in cash, and now we do everything electronically. It's all digits and zeros, ones and zeros.
Yeah, it's strange. But then on the other hand, I went to my insurance company and I went to pay my insurance bill with money, and they said, "I'm sorry, we don't take cash."
Believe it or not, that happened a lot. There was a gentleman that got arrested about 2 months ago, or a month and a half ago, was on Facebook, because he went into the bank to pay his mortgage, and he wanted to pay the mortgage in the bank with cash. He had like $20,000 cash on him or something. And they refused to take the cash. And he was like, "I've got to pay off my mortgage." And they said, "You got to go use a credit card or do this or this." And he refused to do it. He said, "I don't want to do it that way." So they said that he would be late for his mortgage because they wouldn't take cash. And
wow,
they actually called the police on him and hauled him out because he said, "I'm not leaving until you take my cash because I want to pay this off." And the video, he videotaped it. He actually had his phone with him and videotaped the conversation and posted it, saying, "I can't believe that I can't pay cash for my own house." In a bank.
Yeah, well, they won't let you pay cash at the airport for plane tickets anymore. Then that raises a red flag. You know, somehow you're a drug dealer or something if you pay cash at the airport.
Well, they're really going to be surprised if I walk in there with a bunch of gold coins and say, "Take this."
They might tell you what to do with those gold coins, you know?
I get enough of that from Colorado, Ron, telling me what I can do with things. I don't need it from the airport. All right, well, let's go through this. So Jackie Clay will be at the Self-Reliance Expo in May, and she'll be on stage doing a panel session. You can see her live May 18th and 19th in Colorado Springs. The following weekend, the 25th, 26th, 27th, you can join Jackie up in Minnesota at her classes, and you can book her classes at jackie@backwoodsplural.com. Click on that, send her an email, and she'll get you the information. $100 down, pay the remaining balance when you get up there. No credit cards, no PayPal. Send a check. And you can lock down that. And she is doing some tremendous things out there. And is there a place that they can click and get all this information on all the things you're going to be covering or directly about your class?
Well, I'll tell you, if they just check on my blog, okay, one of my old blogs has got a link, and I'll send a flyer to people. So if they just go to, you know, the Backwoods Home Magazine website and click on the Ask Jackie, and then they can email me through the blog, and I will send them a flyer that has all of the information and a lot more than what we talked about today.
Wonderful. And, you know, guys, people, we make this very easy. It's www.backwoodshome.com. And you can go there. You can also see Jackie's last article, which was Homestead Burnout, which she mentioned earlier. And if you're getting ready to go out there, or the folks that ask questions out there, it's a fantastic article on how not to be a Bubba, how not to do what I do, which is do everything at once and then throw up your hands and say, "Why am I doing this?" and run the other direction. Of course, when I run the other direction, I run into Colorado Ron, and I just run then I have to run the other direction, so I'm back at it.
Yeah, we don't want you to quit. We want you to be successful, have a good life.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us, Jackie. It's always a pleasure, and we'll see you in about a month live at the expo.
Okay, we'll see you then.
All right, thank you very much. All right, guys, we're going to go to break. We're going to go to break. We'll be back right after this, and we'll catch up with Colorado Ron and see how things are going where he is outside. Talk to you soon. Talk to you in 2 minutes.
You're listening to the Preparedness Radio Network. We'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
Thank you. Discover the taste of the sun. Thousands of preppers have acquired a sun oven to have on hand in the event of an emergency and have been pleasantly surprised by the improved taste of sun-cooked foods. Sun ovens are a preparedness item you can start using today. A sun oven will pay for itself by reducing your utility bills and by keeping your house cooler in the summer. Food can be baked, boiled, or steamed at temperatures of 360 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit with the power of the sun. Sun ovens are often confused with homemade solar cookers, but they get considerably hotter, cook food faster, and hold temperatures longer. Sun ovens fold up in seconds, carry like a suitcase, and have many innovative features which make them the ultimate solar appliance. For the past 25 years, sun ovens have been proudly made in the U.S. They are durable and have a long life and come with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. For a discount coupon, email preppers at sunoven.com. That's preppers at sunoven.com.
I'm Dr. Prepper, and I'm here today to tell you about the Wonder Mill. Their patented grain mills create the most luxurious and quality flours from any hard grains or beans. They contract with the world's best-suited factories to manufacture the Wonder Mill to the highest specifications in the industry that they plan and design right up there in Pocatello, Idaho. They are the only American company with both electric and hand-operated models. I like them so much, I bought both, and you should too. I use the electric model for the finest flour, and I use the hand-operated model for making my grits and creamy wheat for breakfast, and I can have it fresh every day. With the Wonder Mill's lifetime warranty and the fact that these are simply the world's fastest, quietest, cleanest operating grain mills, it's no wonder that most preparedness and kitchen professionals prefer the Wonder Mill over all the other grain mills on the market. I love both mine. I know you'll love yours, too. Go to thewondermill.com. That's thewondermill.com. And Wonder Mill Grain Grinders. Get yours today. Tell them that Dr. Prepper sent you, will you?
Thanks for listening to a word from our sponsors. Now, back to the show on the Preparedness Radio Network.
Thank you, and welcome back to Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed, with Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci. You there, Colorado?
I am here. How are you?
You lose him on the phone?
I'm here.
Oh, there
I'm
he
here.
Is. Learn to operate the mute button, buddy.
Yep, I'm so, down here. And where am I? Where are we at? Springdale?
Springdale. Well, we're Springdale, Arkansas. Or as I used to say it when I was younger, Arkansas.
Arkansas, yes. Yes, we're in Springdale, Arkansas. At the Popular Mechanics, was it Home Safety Show?
I believe and, that's the actual title.
Yeah. So I'm actually walking around trying to figure out how to sneak in there because it's not open yet.
So, yeah, it actually opens in 1 hour for anybody that wants to come down here. It's at the Holiday Inn in Springdale. It's at the convention center next door. And I believe it opens at 11. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, open from 11 to 4, so it's about a 5-hour show.
So, you know, it's pretty exciting. You know, Colorado Ron and I got in here last night, and I kept some of the stories, you know, so we could talk about them together when we got here. We got here last night, and we ran into and had dinner with Doc Bones and Nurse Amy. We ran into and Colorado Ron is the schmoozer of the group. He's got a great personality and I'm not, you know, I walk around in a dark cowboy hat brooding all the time. And so, you know, he sees Survivor Mom and she comes up and runs and gives him a hug and says, "Oh," and he had just met her about 2 weeks ago, right? We talked about this on our last show. It was two weeks ago.
Yeah, just met her. Uh-huh.
And, you know, had dinner with her and her husband and kind of hit it off, and he hits it off with everybody. And that's why we're good together because he goes out there and he gets to meet everybody and he's friendly, and then he goes, "Yeah, he's actually an okay guy." You know, forget the sourpuss face and the dark hat and together. I'm you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to start a new trend, Prepper Goth. I got the dark hat. I got the brooding look. I'll just change all my clothes to black, And, you know, I'll walk around there. I'll be a prepper, but I'll be the Goth Prepper. Ooh, I can even change the name from Bubba Da Vinci to the Goth Prepper. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah. No, but I'm just playing. Yeah, but we had, and then she was very nice and said hi to us. And then, you know, James T. Stevens, who is Dr. Prepper, also another host on our show, we got to see him in face-to-face. But we also got to see someone, we've met all these people before. I actually had met Lisa Bedford once before. But we both got to meet someone, two people that we had never met before that we've talked to and we've listened to their shows. And who was that, Colorado Ron? In North Carolina?
I'm sorry.
I said, who was that that we met in North Carolina?
Oh, we met Donna Miller and Vicki Lynn.
That's right, Vicki Lynn Haycraft. And wow, what delightful women they were.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was like meeting family. It was great. Loved it.
You know, it was. And actually, Vicki Lynn brought her son, and who actually does some audio work for us. And, you know, what a fantastic young man. The only downside I had with our conversation with him was he still uses a PC, and we had to convert him to Mac. I mean, it was like, you know, we spent a good 15 minutes explaining to him that he was wasting his talents and his time because he was still trying to convince everybody that PC was the way to go. And as everybody on this show knows, Macintosh is where it's at. And if we probably just lost half our audience right there. But wonderful people. We sat down. We had breakfast with them at Colorado Ron's favorite place to eat. Where was that?
Cracker Barrel.
Colorado Ron. I don't think he ever realized how many Cracker Barrels there were east of the Mississippi. I mean, we couldn't go in. We couldn't pass a town without seeing a big Cracker Barrel sign.
Guess who I'm here with? Guess who I just ran into?
Who's who?
Dr. Prepper himself.
Hey, James Stevens. How you doing?
Yeah, I just walked in the show. Like I said, I snuck in and walked in the show. I ran into James Stevens here. He's working the Aquapail booth for his product and the book, you know, Making the Best of Basics. So pretty cool.
Give him a big hello for us.
Everybody says hello. Here, you want to say something? You just speak into that mic.
Hi, everybody. How you doing? Wish you were here.
Well, there you go.
All right. So, when we did our drive, I was trying before unfortunately, my microphone got a little kinky. I was telling everybody that we had made a decision to follow the, is it Dives, Diners, and Drive-Ins food plan.
Oh my gosh, what were we thinking?
I know, and I personally had never seen the show, but Colorado Ron was telling us about the show, and we said, okay, we're going to do it. And
huge fan of the show.
And so here we are driving, and our first stop is Nashville, Tennessee. And he pulls this thing up, you know, pulls up their website, and he's like, okay, here they recommend. There's three places they highly recommend here. One is a Cajun place. One is Jamaican food, and the third was a Greek restaurant. So I love Cajun food, and I said, let's do Cajun. And then he starts reading off these recipes. Oh, they make jambalaya this and gumbo that, and oh my. He starts reading these things off, and drool is running. We haven't eaten in like 7 hours. You know, because we got off the plane, we started driving, we had a quick bite to eat. As Steak and Shake, which we'll go into that another day. And his rules coming down there, and so he goes, I'll call and I'll find out what time they close. So after he got me all built up on this, he calls and they find out they're not open after 3 p.m. on the weekdays, and they're open all day on the weekends. So we found this trend that everything in the South seems to roll up. They all seem to close at 5 p.m.
That's right.
So, long story short, we had a great meal at a Greek restaurant, and it was Athens. It was the Athens Family Restaurant.
Yeah. I think we tagged ourselves on Facebook or something from there. But yeah, I think it was Athens Family Restaurant, something like that. Yeah.
Right. And the food there, just was completely spot on. The food was fantastic. We gorged ourselves before we finished our drive. And then went there, met with Vicki Lynn and Donna. And then on our drive back, we found another little dive that introduced us to something we both, I think, are in love with now.
Oh, my gosh. Chocolate gravy.
People, have you ever heard of chocolate gravy? This is ridiculous. It's so good. Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like heart attack by the spoonful right there, buddy. I'm telling you, it's so good. But man.
I mean, open,
you pour it over the biscuits. Remember, you pour it over the biscuits. It's chocolate gravy over biscuits.
Right. And it's made just like regular gravy, except for with chocolate. I mean, it's got flour and all that stuff. And you serve it up hot. You crack open your biscuit. You pour it over there. Oh. Swear to God, we got in the car and neither one of us could move.
Yep. I mean, exactly.
it was pretty bad. But then after
we were busting gut. I mean, yeah. Every bump you hit, it was a killer.
So Colorado Ron said, you know, the next stop to go drive through. Originally, our plan was we got up in the morning, we were going to have a light breakfast, and then we were going to stop in Memphis to have some good old Southern food on the Road of the King. You know, B.B. King.
Yeah,
Elvis,
that's
we were
right.
And so that was our plan. That's right.
Yeah, Home we were going to get some barbecue at Home of the Blues. You know, hey, you can't miss out on that, right? Unless
right. Well,
freaking stuff to move.
Exactly. Unfortunately, by the time we arrived in Memphis, neither one of us could still move. So we walked the streets and stared and smelled all this wonderful food and couldn't even touch it.
Nope, couldn't even touch it. It smelled so good, but there was no way I could eat another bite. I was still stuffed. How many hours later was that?
I think it was like 3 hours later, and we're still getting sick.
Yeah, and I napped in the car trying to sleep it off so that I could be ready.
Did you really sleep? There was so much traffic leaving in and out and everything else. I never really paid attention. I thought I heard you snore a couple of times.
Yeah, I was sleeping. I slept, I slept a good 20, 30 minutes, hoping to sleep it off so that I could be ready to eat. But, yeah, that didn't work.
Well, that's okay. But it was a good drive. It's beautiful country out here. I mean, just for anybody that's from Tennessee or Arkansas or things like that, we greatly appreciate your hospitality. People were very, very friendly to us as we went through. And you have beautiful country here. We loved it. You still there, Colorado Ron? We drop you.
Nope, I'm here. Yeah, it was a great time. The people were great. The hospitality was awesome. Everybody was friendly. And, you know, the fact that they were willing to introduce us to all these new foods. They said, well, we know you ain't from the South because you don't know what chocolate gravy is. So let us show you this and this and this. And I've never been to a breakfast buffet that had chocolate gravy, tomato gravy, had grits, fried bologna, all these things. That was a true Southern breakfast buffet.
Well, yeah, and then I actually posted a picture of Colorado Ron with his plate in his hands, and basically it was a heart attack in a plate. I mean, there was so much fried food on there that it was just like you could hear it. I mean, his poor wife all the way back in Colorado could hear his arteries hardening as he was putting a spoonful in his mouth.
Totally.
That's how much you know food was on that plate and how much stuff, you know, but it was excellent. Every place we stopped in, the people talked to us. We joked around with them. You know, we told people what we did. You know, trying to get people into self-reliance and people actually talk to us and not run away. Which, yeah, the reason I do radio is I definitely have a face for radio, so running away would have been an option. But it was fun, and I think it was a good experience for us, and we're glad that we made it here, and hopefully we'll be able to get some more information, talk to some people while we're here at this event and get it up on the website and get some interviews for next week. Our next guest is going to be Alan from Doomsday Preppers. Actually,
I always say doomsday preppers, and it's not really doomsday preppers. Alan is the executive producer, I believe, and he's probably going to correct me when he comes on, for Sharp Entertainment. Sharp Entertainment is the company who does doomsday preppers for National Geographic. And we started talking to Alan, early last year when they were doing their casting call for the first show, for first episode. First season. I keep saying episode. First season. And we feel very honored because when we watched the show, we're a little above 50% right now of the people that are on the show came from our expo.
Yeah, we saw him at the expo. It was awesome. It was cool. It was like, hey, I know that guy. It was really fun.
That's right. So win for the Self-Reliance Expo, win for Doomsday Preppers. Everybody, yeah, it's pretty good. So he's honoring us by actually jumping on here. We're going to hear a little bit about what's coming on upcoming episodes and maybe even try to convince him to give us a little tip about season two, if there's a season two and what they're going to be looking at. So, Steve, is Alan on the phone?
Yes.
All right, let's bring him on in.
Hey, how's it going, Alan?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Wonderful.
Doing
nice to hear from you again. How's everything in New York City?
New York City is a beautiful spring day, and so we're coming out of our winter, and it's the best time to be here. So everyone's in a good mood, and it's just beautiful out here. And yes, I am the executive producer of Doomsday Preppers. You got it right.
Are you kidding me? He got it right?
Yeah, it's hard to believe he got one thing right on that whole no.
Wow.
Wow, you're getting it from both ends today.
I might as well just do it. Every guest we have on gives it to me. I mean, Jackie Clay, who's the most wonderful, quiet woman in the world, is giving it to me. Now I got the New Yorker.
She's back to around.
I'm going to have to be able to go a notch higher than Jesse, the nicest woman in the world, okay? I'm a hardened New Yorker, okay? So,
well, that's okay.
You set the bar, I got to beat it.
Okay. But you realize I'm the one that sets up your mic when you come and you speak.
Oh.
All right, I'll be nice, I promise. I do well with others, I really do.
So, first of all, Alec, congratulations, Doomsday Prepper, a runaway success.
It is. It really is, and I'm loving every minute of it. It really hit a chord nationally, and we've gotten a huge amount of interest in it and a lot of people watching, and I couldn't be happier.
And I like to tell everybody a little story. About a year, not quite a year ago, when we started talking to Alan, and I believe it was Paige, we started talking to, and I decided I was going to fly out to New York. Colorado Ron and I were talking, and he goes, "You're heading that direction. Why don't you pop in?" And I popped in in Alan's office and met everybody and was chatting. And at that point, people were kind of being very negative and saying, this is not going to work, and people, there's a chance that people aren't going to want to watch this and everything else. And Alan said to me, "Look, if you make it entertaining, I think we believe that this is something that people are going to want to watch." Every episode, as I watch it, I watch the Facebook stuff and everything else, it just grows. I think you hit a chord, both on, kind of being funny and letting people see some of the quirkier things about what prepping can be, but also every single episode is educational. I think people get some information.
That was always our goal, Scott. And I said to you from the first moment, we had two E's: educational and entertainment. And it's funny, because I have to, I stay in touch with the blogs and read all the comments from people. We are about 50% people who, oh my gosh, we hate it. It's just a comedy, a joke. And then 50% who are like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. That is so cool. And so I try to, of course, ignore the, not positive comments, but I take it with a grain of salt and know that, look, this is what I have to do and we have to do as a channel to get people to watch. some people say, oh, we want it to be more fact-based and more, why do you have to do it, be so sensational? I'm like, well, I have two choices. I could either pay my college, my kids' college education and get people to watch, or no one will watch. And I lose out on both ends. It's neither entertaining or educational. So it's really been an important balance that we strike and discuss every day at work.
And what are they? What's, and I'm sure I'm misquoting because I do it every week. I misquote some sort of statement, and I get an email or a Facebook thing saying, "No, what was actually said was this." But you know, didn't someone say that you know, the greatest form of flattery is imitation? And
yeah.
And since you guys have launched your show, there's all these shows popping up everywhere. You've got the Today Show pulling people online talking about the prepping industry. You know, so if that was the way it was stated. You know, you've got to be very flattered that, you know, that your success has made the prepping industry really kind of stand out and, you know, mainstream media and everybody's picking it up.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, we get calls for press every day and it really has, struck a chord with people and, people are very interested on many levels. It's really is a national kind of thing. And when I first attended the expo, I guess almost a year ago, I guess. No, it would be about 6 months ago, right? The first expo.
Yeah, that was Denver. You came? Yeah.
In Denver.
So that would have been in September, October timeframe. Yeah.
And I'll be excited to see the next expo I go to. and I think it's, although I know people, it's doomsday preppers and we show some of the extremes, I think the regular prepper or the beginning prepper now is, or just people, are checking stuff out, looking around and saying, you know what, I might need a little water in my closet. And I'm going to buy a couple extra cans of beans this week or something like that. So it is kind of interesting to me on many levels, from the really super preppers, picked out preppers who we talk to and get contacted by, right up to the beginning preppers who are just starting out. And I think the show appeals to both.
Well, you know, and I imagine that you guys are getting all kinds of inquiries now, you know, from preppers that are, both wanting to. I guess the term is, you know, correct you, because they think everybody wants to think they know it better, and I imagine you're getting a ton of inquiries from both sides of the fence.
Yes, and I love both, and we're even, you know, if we get a second season, which we are keeping our fingers crossed, and I think it'll possibly be announced this week, I am interested in both. The really tricked out preppers, super preppers, extreme preppers, and also maybe having a couple beginners on another season, you know, kind of showing how people are starting off as well. And so we get both. And of course, as you said, we get a lot of criticism, or not really criticism, maybe let's call them people correcting us. Oh no, that's not the way to do it. I would do this. And I'm like, hey, you want to be on next year? We'd love to have you.
Oh man,
now,
that's a good one.
Now I have to ask. I have to imagine that when you put out a show like this, that a portion of the emails, probably a large portion, are people saying, well, this is good, but let me tell you about my idea. Here's a better show. And,
yes.
And you probably get a lot of those inquiries. I mean, is it a lot or is it really not that many?
There's, of course, no end to everyone who's willing to tell you how to do your job properly. Fortunately, I only have to worry about my boss, okay, making sure that I do my job properly. But no, we get a lot of ideas for new shows and new concepts and ways to make it better. And I appreciate all of them. Sometimes I'll come across one and go, oh, that is a good idea. Maybe we can do that. And I guess a lot of them are also saying, you know, it should be much more about prepping. You know, we want to know you're making it look like we're all extreme. And I try to explain to them that those are the things that people really want to watch. You know,
right.
The more amazing things that are out there that people have prepped. And if you show them those, then the audience at large might pick up some tips from it.
Right. Well, that was actually a segue. Hold on. That was actually a segue because Colorado and Ron and I have a great TV idea about two handsome men that have a radio show that interview an executive producer who can get them a show. It's a great idea. It's just a big circle.
I don't want to trot out that old saying about a face for radio.
okay, of course. See, I knew admitting it live would come back and bite me someday. So that's definitely a problem. All right. So we'll get it together. I interrupted you, Ron. Go ahead. I'm going to go here and pout.
Yeah, go lick your wounds. Hey, I just had a quick question. You know, obviously, a lot of our listeners come to the Self-Reliance Expo, and none of us intend, well, at least I don't. I never intend to, and me not being part of your industry, you know, I never intend to be one of those people, you know, like when I was, you know, in a company, a certain company, everybody came up and had the same thing. They always wanted to tell me the same thing or tell me how to do my job or, you know, things like that. What is it that you guys, you know, that you're like, oh, not again. So when they come to you, they're more prepared to give you that information that you're looking for. Does that make any sense?
I think what he's asking is how to get you the pitch. How to walk up there so they don't sound like everybody else, but they can approach you in a way that, you know, that's beneficial for both of you.
I guess there's no one way. We're usually pretty open about it, or I should say I am at least. So I'm kind of a listener. So I'm willing to listen to anybody, you know, as long as I have the time. And if they truly have a pitch, I mean, if you mean in terms of people who want to be on the show or want to start a new show, Ron?
Well, just being on your show, you know, there's always a certain amount of people that come and either tell you the same thing or tell you something that you just, I've heard that a million times today. Or,
right.
Or, you know, please don't tell me how to do my job or whatever it may be. You know, what are some of the ways we can streamline this process for you guys?
Well, I love hearing about people's unusual preps and things that are, of course, out of the ordinary that people have not heard about yet, and new ideas and new gadgets and new equipment that kind of is unusual. That's going to be eye-catching and get people to watch our show. People always ask me, what do you do? How do you describe what you do? And my first job is to attract eyeballs. That's what I do. You know, anything I can do to attract people to get into it, to watch it, that's my first priority. And then after that, I'm trying to tell a story. And so I'm also interested in compelling stories and also a diversity of the prepper community, trying to show the diversity of the prepper community, which is, for me, was eye-opening. I have to say, this is my first foray into that world, and one of the things that was so amazing to me was the diversity of that community. And we have about, let's see, probably about 20 states represented in the first season. If we do get a second season, which we are all very hopeful about and pretty sure we're going to get it, I'll keep my fingers crossed, my goal is to get all 50 states. So I want all 50 states with preppers in them. You know, wherever we have to travel to get them. And that is one of the goals. That's what makes it interesting. We have a huge diversity of people, women, men, different ethnic backgrounds, different religions, and different preps, different things that they're concerned about in different geographic locations.
Okay, I have a question from the chat room. And it says, where do you find your extreme preppers? So where do the extreme preppers come from?
They usually come to us. There's a casting card at the back of the show, and they email us and say, you know, we'd like to be on your show. Other things we do, we just like this, I do a lot of outreach to the prepper community. I went to the expo. We always have a presence at expos around the country and conventions around the country, and we'll have a casting table, and people come up and say, hey, I have a bunker. I have a blank. And we're like, okay, here, fill this out. Let's talk to you, see what you got.
Well, yeah, you're not trying to make us look like a bunch of crazies now, are you?
Well, that's my goal.
specifically us, Colorado.
Yeah,
we get a lot of that, and I really have to answer that question seriously. You're not trying to make me look like a crazy, are you? I think we've done a really great job of being even-handed and portraying the people as they are. We are very non-judgmental in our approach, and you could, you know, contradict me on this or say no or criticize me and say, no, I don't think so. But I think we're pretty non-judgmental. We show what the people do. We don't make up what they do. Sometimes we try to dramatize it because that's our job and make it visual and interesting and amp it up a little. But, you know, by and large, the people, I'm not making the people up, and I'm not putting guns to their head. They have all the guns usually. I just have the camera.
That's a good point.
So I think it's a pretty fair deal. I show up with a camera and they have guns. They have the power, you know? So to make them look crazy is not our goal. To portray what they do and what their concerns are and how they do it is entirely my goal.
And that makes sense. We have another question from the gray void out here, and that's, are you going to have more camera input from the people who evaluate the preppers and follow up on the featured preppers so we can see what they've done since the show?
Good question.
That's by Vicky Lynn.
one of my favorite aspects of the show is the update, and I just love it. It is unvarnished. It's people who listen to the criticism and think about it, and they put the camera up and they tell us what they think and what they've done to improve their preps, and it's truly my favorite part. I don't know if we're going to have more of that. It's very hard to do the update. We would probably have to send a camera crew back, but we are considering doing kind of for our best of series, which we're going to probably have a best of this season to end the season. We're going to do kind of a compilation and some never-before-seen footage and stuff like that. But in the second season, I would love to have maybe one episode where we go back and we say, hey, let's go check out this guy and see what they're doing now or what they've built or how they've improved their preps or where they've gone from where you saw them at the beginning. So that's one thing I really want to do. I think it would be really a lot of fun.
So can I do one of those? Earlier I was joking when I was pitching our show, but can I actually throw out a concept and not trying to tell you to do your job? I just think it would be wonderful.
Sure. I would love to hear it.
Okay. Well, you know, I would, and Colorado Ron hopefully will back me up on this. I would be honored. We're lucky enough. We haven't covered this yet, but I'll throw it out there right now. We're honored to have Alan, who will be coming out to our show in May, and will be hosting a open discussion on stage, on our main stage, about the show and letting people do live questions and answers. And we'll actually have it up on where you can Twitter and Facebook your questions into Alan. And we think that's a wonderful thing. We appreciate you coming out there and confronting this semi-hostile audience in person. We promise we'll put gun dealers on both sides of you in case things get out of hand.
I'll tell everybody that I've learned enough in my first year of doing this show to defend myself quite well. I don't know if you – did you see the episode with the guy who taught Krav Maga?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm taking it now. Okay, that's it.
Good for you. But what I was going to suggest is if – we don't know if we can pull it together by May or whatever, but we have several shows at the end of the year. I'd be honored to host a – almost a round table at the show with several of your guests. Like, we already have Lisa Bedford that will be at this next show. We have Kayleen, you know, Bishop that will be there. So we have some of your people that have only not only come to our events, but there. Host a panel session up there with all of you guys and let everybody on stage and broadcast it live on Facebook or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Ask the questions of those people about how it's changed their lives and what they've done since the show. I mean, I think that would be great for the prepper community for at our events.
I would, whatever you set up, I'm up for. I'm very proud of the show.
You heard it here.
The Bubba Da Vinci Colorado Rancho to launch next year. You heard it here first.
Maybe I should revise what I said. Almost anything that you set up.
Dang it.
I don't know you well enough yet, Scott, to really exactly say anything you set up.
I appreciate your honesty there. I
just wanted to ask you a question, though. When you said before, you know, going there, and I'll be there no matter what. Of course, work would be the only thing that would stop me. But when you say semi-hostile audience, do you really think that it would be semi-hostile, that people in the prepper community are not totally enjoying the show or hostile about it?
Yeah, well, hostile not in a physical sense. Listen, Colorado Ron gets on stage, and the thing about the prepper community, and he brought it up earlier, is I think the best thing about our community. There's 1,000 ways to do every single thing. And we actually just had a breakfast this morning a bunch of us were sitting around, and everybody gets passionate about it. It's not, I'm going to throw things at you. It's not you're at risk. And I think most people on both sides of the fence enjoy your show. You're just going to have a lot of people out there doing what we said earlier, telling you how you're doing it wrong, and why don't you listen to me, you know, because this is a better way to do it. So
okay, that's good. No, it's good to know, and I just want to make sure. I mean, part of the way we do a lot of outreach to the prepper community. I don't pretend to be an expert at prepping, and I want to hear all that stuff. I want them on our side.
And if it was going to be hostile, you were going to send poor Brooklyn, weren't you? I know you.
What's that?
I said if I had said yes, it was going to be physically hostile, you were going to send poor Brooklyn to be on stage, weren't you?
Yes, exactly. No, I was hoping.
I can't be there. I'm sorry.
I was hoping for physically hostile. That's, you know, again, I come from New York, so it really, that aspect of it doesn't bother me so much.
Okay. Yeah, unfortunately, we're not Jerry Springer yet. Yeah, we're the closest off the line of that stuff.
That's right. And anyone in the prepper community who have met Brooklyn, she is a one step below Southern Belle. So, or I guess I'd call her a Southern Belle, and she's a nice one in our company.
Well, I mean, can you give us any hints about, you've got how many episodes left in the season?
We have 3 more episodes to air, 2 that are going to be all new episodes. So, I'm sorry, 3 more all new episodes, which start this Tuesday, is a really great episode, and I'm so excited for it to air and see what the Twitter and the Facebook comments are on this one, because it's Bruce Beach, Bradford Frank, and Jeremy Niche. And I call it, the title of the episode is It's Going to Get Worse, but we affectionately call it The Bus, The Beast, and The Doctor. Because Bruce Beach has buried 42 buses underground. As a bunker.
Cool.
Okay. Oh, it's so way cool. And he's just fascinating. I mean, what a great character. Fascinating stuff. Jeremy Niche has an army vehicle for bug outs, which he calls the Beast. And it's really awesome. And Bradford Frank is a doctor in San Diego who is a Yale-educated psychiatrist who preps. again, the diversity of the prepping community. So it's a really, really good episode. And then we have two more new ones, and at the end of the season, we're going to have the best of. So we have four more episodes coming up, I guess.
If you do a live hosting there, Colorado Ron and I want to come and see this. I'd love to see people interact. Is it just going to be video clips, or are you going to you're thinking about actually having some of them there and do some stuff live? Or have you decided yet?
Oh, we haven't really decided yet. Yeah. I haven't yet decided what we're going to do with that.
Well, if you do end up, give us an invitation. We'll go to New York or wherever it is, because I'd love to see some of these people. Each individual, it's kind of funny. You get preppers together, and each one of them have an interesting story. But Colorado and I, Ron and I, have had the experience where you put three or four of them together and you watch the interaction, and it is hilarious. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
It's so funny.
It's good entertainment.
All right. I want to talk to my bosses about that one. We'll see if we could set up some kind of – I would love to do some kind of round table end thing that would be at the end of the show or an extra half hour onto the show where we would get the preppers and also the people who did the assessments and have kind of a round table discussion about it. And I actually have people tweet in questions similar to this, but on television.
Yeah, I think that would be great. Or just getting like the alien prepper across from the economic disaster prepper. Because each one of them, and when you're doing different things, they all have different perceptions of what you need and what's right. And I think it would just be a dynamic conversation to see those people go around.
Yeah, it would be interesting. And they have strong opinions about what they do. There's no doubt about that.
So have you become a prepper at all by having seen what you've seen and seeing both the conservative and the kooky, and everything in between, has your perception about what's going on in the world and how much to be prepared, or has it changed? I mean, as a New Yorker, New York motto is kind of just live life and just do what you got to do.
Well, things changed here a little after 9/11 in terms of maybe people don't call it prepping as much here, or maybe didn't have a word to put to it. Is that fair to say? Maybe we didn't call it prepping, but things changed here in terms of knowing where your family has to be at certain times or if how to communicate when – the stuff goes down and how to get out of the city, et cetera. Minor things like, not minor, but things like that, aspects of prepping like that. And that was about 10 years ago. And then for me, after that, starting this, I have to admit that I do keep water in my closet now. And when we do go to Costco or one of these, I don't want to give them a plug, one of these bulk stores, we might buy more of what we usually had bought. And we also had the scare for the hurricane this past year.
Right around the beginning of the winter.
Yes, exactly. And people bought a little more. And, I have to say, walking into the supermarket the day before was a prepper's nightmare, an unprepared prepper's nightmare. The shelves were bare. It was shocking.
Wow.
Basically, you were faced with the idea of, I'm going to eat chocolate sprinkles for the next 3 weeks if this really happens. Because that's the only thing that was left on the shelves that day. So, things like that happen that illustrate the need to be prepped. And part of my thing with everything, I don't consider myself a true prepper or anything like that, but I have been influenced by it and do think about it often. And my pantry is a little more full. And the bottom of my closet does have gallons of water in it. Okay, there you go. But I also, we had... what we didn't really call them go bags, but again, after 9/11, New Yorkers did readjust certain behaviors, and you know, did have a go bag, let's say, under your bed or something, where you could just say, you know, I'm taking it, I'm out of here for 3 days or whatever until I know what is happening.
Sorry, I went away for a second. It's good to hear, and I think it's good for the audience to hear that, you know, someone that's participating, you know, and creating a show like this is actually taking something away. Because I believe a lot of people think that if you have someone that is part of the show that actually has a sensitivity, because I think most preppers don't like to be looked at as extremists. There are a few. You know, in any business, you have the people that like to stand up and say, look at me.
Right.
I honestly believe in my heart that most people that are self-reliant, prepping, whatever you want to say, do it for a couple reasons. Number one, so they're prepared. And number two, they want to educate people to be part of it. And I'm hoping that by you making that statement and everything else, people will realize, look, your job is still to make it entertaining, but it's influenced you. And if it can influence you, then you're going to – hopefully what you do will help influence others, you know. And it'll make a difference.
You know, all you have to do is read the comments on Twitter or on Facebook. And again, we have this great diversity of people who are watching. We do get a large portion of the prepper community watching. and then, of course, you know, given the ratings we have, we get people who are not preppers who are watching. And some of the tweets are, you know what? I want to get blank. That's a good idea. I don't believe in this, but. And, you know, what more do you want? You know, that is the educational aspect of it, that people do, we do change people's minds a little on certain aspects of prepping. I don't think I'm going out to bury a bus under concrete. That will not be my prep. But
oh, come on, that's cool.
it is cool, but real estate here in New York is so expensive that it would just be phenomenally expensive to bury a bus here, okay? I just can't do it. And I might get arrested, you know, if I started burying buses on Broadway. That would be anyway. Where was I? But that's not going to be my prep, but I might. And I do have water in my closet, so there you have it. You know, and I'm I always say, you know, look, I'm by nature a skeptic. I think to do what I do, one is separated from the situation by a camera lens, and so you're kind of the observer. But you know, I hold myself up and say, you know, I'm a classic example. I am a skeptic. I'm a skeptical New Yorker. And, you know, again, in my closet, there's a couple gallons of water. So how skeptical? You know, you even broke through to me.
I'll tell you what. I'm in a volunteer Colorado, Ron. That when you come to the event, walk around with him and his wonderful wife, Heather, and just let him kind of introduce you to the vendors and everything else. And it seems more daunting, and I'm kind of skeptical by nature also. But once you see how easy it is and how basic it is and how much your life, you know, how much relief you have in your life going, well, if I've got to take care of my family, I know that I've got 3-4 months worth of food in there, because it doesn't go bad, right? It makes more sense to do it than not. If you walk out of that and you aren't doing a little bit more prepping, I'd be surprised. Because also Colorado Ron's a big guy and intimidating, and he'll make you do it. So.
Well, I thought the expo was fascinating. I had a really great time, and what really opened my eyes was also all the diversity of products and the thought that went into all of it. You know, all the different angles that are covered in self-reliance. It was endlessly fascinating to me. You know, of course, things that you don't ever think about. And, you know, that's part of the show as well. You know, show people, oh, I never even knew that. I didn't think about that. So, but I definitely look forward to the expo and eating at another Denver steakhouse.
Yeah, you like that.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big fan of Denver. I've been there a bunch of times. I love it.
Were you ever at that restaurant before?
No, that was my first time. That was my first time there, and it was really quite a lot of fun.
Good.
Well, what was the name of the restaurant, Ron?
It was Buckhorn Exchange.
Yeah,
that was fantastic. Although, if we ever do something like that again, you know, Ron, you got to make sure that your wife and I and the rest of the people don't have to sit at the kids' table. We got relegated up. Yeah, he booted us upstairs again. It's the face. You can't say that about your wife. She was sent upstairs to keep me company. But he was like, you know, he goes, you're gonna scare the feathers off the animal. So go upstairs and you know don't. He'll see you and he'll you know poor Alan will see you and think all preppers look like you and then he won't want to put you on camera.
I'm going to have to check the date to see if there's a Rocky game also that day. I'm a big baseball fan as well, so I look for any opportunity to see a baseball game outside of Yankee Stadium, of course. But you know, that's one of my better, bigger hobbies. You know, I just love baseball and love traveling around and seeing different stadiums and everything like that. So I realize now it'll be baseball season, so I'm going to have to go check that out.
I have one question that I wanted to ask is, were you, as an executive producer, surprised at the diversity and socioeconomic diversity of the people that you were getting on your show? I mean, when you put the concept together and someone said, hey, Alan, you know, we're looking about a prepper show, I'm sure the concept that came in your head were like, you know, rednecks and hillbillies and this and that and everything else. And were you surprised when you got doctors and lawyers and highly educated people all the way down to, you know, people like, you know, Survivor Redneck Mom. and Bubba's. But, I mean, like someone like Survivor Mom who's basically a homemaker. I mean, were you surprised about the economic and the general diversity of the people?
Absolutely. I mean, when I first started, I had little preconceptions about the diversity of the people because, quite honestly, I didn't even know. I was worried more that there was only going to be five people. that when they told me I was doing a show about preppers, I would have five. And I didn't know.
He's like, oh, great, one season.
I will do it right. One season, one show. I thought that was it. Or maybe I could put mustaches on them for the second show or something like that. But then when I started, I was blown away of the number of people who were sending in applications, not really applications, but saying, you know, I'm a prepper. Would you guys be interested in coming here? And that was the first thing I was blown away by. I was like, oh my gosh, there are hundreds, okay, and if not thousands. But part of the thing is, and what I think we've done a great job of is showing that diversity. And it's always cool for me to get, we had someone, the New England liberal prepper we had a fireman from New York City, all across the country. You know, and in cities, rural, suburban, in every geographic location, and that's really what's fun and exciting to me when I hear about someone else who's, you know, oh, I never heard of that. I never heard of the Everglade prepper. I'm gonna have to do that one. You know, so
nice.
So, have you guys heard of an Everglade prepper? That's what I'm looking for now. No.
Alligator. Wow, that's specific. Okay, I mean something. We'll go out. We're enjoying our roach. Maybe I can convince Ron to go ahead and take a trip. Actually, we got to go to Dallas anyway. Maybe we can hit the Everglades and we'll find them one.
Okay.
Why not? Right? Why not?
Oh my goodness.
that's just the way we are. This is how much we like to help and we like your.
All right, I'm going to make a list. You know, the Everglade Glade prepper. Really, what I want is the Hawaiian prepper. Okay, because then I get. I'm going to shoot that one.
You got one of them. You got one of them. But
oh, really?
I'll give you his name, but you got to make sure that we go as video advisors.
Consultants. No, we got to bring my. I got to bring the consultants on this one. I know it's
That's
hard.
Right.
But
yeah. That's right. We want to see our name. We want to see our. We want to credit. Yeah, I just love to see, you know, courtesy of Bubba Da Vinci and Colorado Ron at the end of the segment. Let me just be one. And my days would be fulfilled. We'd feel wonderful. Anyway, all right. Well, we're at the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
We are talking to Alan from Doomsday Preppers. Actually, he's the executive producer for Sharp Entertainment, who is the creators of Doomsday Preppers. Hopefully, Alan, you'll be able to give us an update this next week and say you got picked up for another session, and maybe we can officially announce that you're doing a casting call at our event again. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Let's make
it a date. You tell Brooklyn when you want to speak to me again. We'll, as soon as I know, we'll announce it, and you know we'll get everything together, and I'll talk to you guys again.
Awesome. Wonderful. And your series is on National Geographic's Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Correct.
Correct.
And you have three. Go ahead.
I would say this week I recommend everybody, even people who have not tried it out. If they watch 1 week, this should be the week that they watch, because it's a really high quality, interesting show that we put out this year, this particular week.
I'm
really excited about it.
And for people who would like to, go ahead. Sorry, Ron. Go ahead.
Is this the bus one?
Yes, exactly.
Ah, sweet.
Yes.
And they can tweet you at Doomsday Plus Preppers. Is that correct? On Twitter? Twitter you?
I don't know that. Is that
what it is?
I don't
That's
have
what
a Twitter. I'm too old to have a Twitter. They won't let me have one at my at work.
I mentioned it to them.
I've heard about this tweeting thing, but really they said, no, Mr. Madison, you're too old.
you got to work with us, Alan. You're supposed to know these things. So when I give you the plugs, you're sitting there going, oh, yes, that's what it is.
Yeah, but the tweeter thing is just like, I don't know. I'm too old for that. Everyone makes fun of me with that. So next time we speak, I will have the Twitter thing set up. I'll write it down on my hand so that I understand it. But, you know, right now it's just like, you guys can call me. Call me direct. I don't care. The Twitter thing I don't understand, so you guys can call me direct, okay?
Well, just so you guys know, on your Facebook, if you guys want to populate anything on there, go to Doomsday Preppers, Doomsday one word, Preppers plural, second word. Like their page, good information up there. They put their URLs, they put their groups up there, even if Alan doesn't know what they are. and you can contact him about possibly being on the show. So, thank you very much for coming on again, Alan. It's always a pleasure dealing with you guys. And again, we are very, very happy with your success and that you proved, you know, that you could match the education and the entertainment and not, you know, and move this thing forward. And we appreciate you.
Oh, well, thanks. And really, I had a great time, guys. Anytime, okay? I'll see you in a couple months.
Will do.
All right,
guys. That was Alan, executive producer of Doomsday Preppers. We'll come back.
Also dished it out to Bubba.
Oh, my God. I'm starting to get a complex. I like to joke around about myself, but usually it's me doing it, and I figure somebody will actually pay me a compliment and say, oh, no, Bubba, you're not that ugly. Oh, no. And every one of them jumps on the bandwagon and smacks me upside the head with a frying pan. What's the deal?
Oh,
you know,
this is awesome.
I'm afraid to invite Vicki Lynn and Donna live on our show because they were so sweet and I had a great impression. Next thing you know, I'm going to get bashed by them too. Anyway, all right, guys. Let's take a break so I can go wipe the tears out of my eyes and stop feeling neglected. We'll be back in 2 minutes and we will get ready to talk to our big, big, bad friend, Mad Mike. And go.
All right.
All right, we'll talk to you guys in two.
You're listening to the Preparedness Radio Network. We'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
Hey, meat eaters. The freeze-dry guy wants to know, does your emergency food supply meet the standards for survival? Then get the 144-day meat variety unit from the freeze-dry guy.
Our meat units utilize only quality Mountain House freeze-dried cooked ground chicken and ground beef, the undisputed choice for great taste and highest nutrition. The Freeze Dry Guy's 144-day meat variety unit includes six number 10 cans of the very best freeze-dried animal protein for power you'll need when the going gets tough. Every Meat Eater's 144-day meat variety unit comes with a free medical kit and always free shipping to the lower 48. Need more than 144 days? See our one-year-plus Meat Eater's units at freezedryguy.com. And hey, the Freeze Dry Guy still has LRP rations, but they're going fast. Don't wait until tomorrow. Call now, 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-3663. Or go to freezedryguy.com and meet the standards for survival.
Looking for power grid independence? The Humless Solar Kit is the answer. Increasing brownouts in the U.S. suggest it's time to get a backup. The problem is gas generators are messy, require maintenance, and oh, gas, which may be scarce in a real emergency. Get the Humless Solar Kit by itself or with a 1,000-watt Humless Sentinel generator. The kit includes a 100-watt solar panel, 20-foot extension cord, LED floodlight, rechargeable flashlights, and more. Become a fan at Humless.com or on Facebook.
Thanks for listening to a word from our sponsors. Now, back to the show on the Preparedness Radio Network.
Welcome back to Backwood Homes Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed with Colorado Ron and Bubba DaVinci. We are here live in Arkansas in Springdale. We're participating with, we're visiting with Popular Mechanics. They're doing a show. Colorado Ron is out there on the floor. Are you out there, Colorado?
I am at the Home Safety Prep Show, and they just opened the doors about 2 minutes ago, so people are starting to come on in, so this is awesome.
Now, I'll be down with you here after the show. We'll snap some pictures, and hopefully, you know, Survival Mom will honor us and taking a picture that we can post up there. She is out. She has her new book out, Prepare More, Panic Less, I think is the name of the book. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the subtitle. Survival Mom is the title of the book.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, there I go again, making a mistake, but that's okay. And we've got a lot of friends down there. I think the Berkey guy is down at the show. And we also know one of our partners and good friends, James T. Stevenson, Dr. Prepper, is at the show.
James Stevens is here. He's working the Aquapale and showing that and demoing that. And also got the book, Making the Best of Basics.
We have
Joe and Amy, right? Yep. We got Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. So they're here, and they're going to be doing a lecture later on in the day, and they're also showing off their book. It's pretty exciting. It's fun to watch all these people starting to flood in the door here. So he's got about, a couple hundred people here through the door. So that's pretty cool.
That's a good way to start.
Yeah, that's a good start. So
I have to say, what did you think about talking? That we were laughing there for a second. Yeah, I like talking. Like talking to Alan. And you know something?
Oh, yeah.
We caught a lot of flack when we wanted to have Doomsday Preppers at our Colorado and our Utah event last year. And so I have a personal question to ask you, Colorado. Do you still feel good that we did it? Because, I mean, honestly, guys, if you looked at our Facebook and you saw the emails that we received, then people coming to the event saying, you know, that this is going to be a horrible thing to prep for preppers. And Colorado Ron, I gave my opinion, and I said, but it's your decision. And he said, you know something, you know, we can't let the audience dictate what we do. We're about education. And it was a great thing to hear come out of his mouth. And so do you still feel good about doing it, Ron?
Absolutely. I have a philosophy, and you've heard me say this before, you know, the rising tide raises all ships. So, the more we get out there, whether it's through entertainment or through education, whatever we do to help get the message out there and get people, you know, like he said, you know, there's just a few more people saying, huh, I didn't think about that. Maybe I should look into it. And then that's when they come and they find, like, the Popular Mechanics Show, and that's when they come out and they find, you know, the Self-Reliance Expo. And that's when they learn and they start buying books and, you know, going to the training classes and learning more and more. And that's exactly what we're here to do. So, you know, he reaches an audience that it would take us a long time to reach. And, you know, whether you agree with the way he's reaching it or not, he is reaching it, and those people are responding, and that's what we want. So I love the fact that Alan's coming to the show. I love that he supports the Self-Reliance Expo, and I am all about, you know, helping him any way we can.
Well, and I agree with you. I think that people have to understand that, you know, sometimes you have to make things funny and entertaining and kind of show, you know, some of our less attractive sides to get people to go ahead and participate. And my philosophy is just like yours, Ron, is I don't care how we get it. If every week or every day we get one more person to pick up the lifestyle and pass it on to the next person, eventually we are going to be a friendlier, safer place, you know, society, and we'll be prepared. We can not only take care of ourselves, but take care of others. And,
exactly. And hopefully it's one more than one, but yeah.
Well, I was saying as a minimum. I mean, if every day we walk up and we got someone, you know, then I consider it a win. You know, I'm loving this job. I mean, we are, you know, this morning we've talked to Jackie Clay, who's a wonderful woman who did it all herself and everything else. You know, we just got through talking to an executive producer of a successful TV show. You're down there rubbing elbows with, you know, with prepper celebrities and the general audience. I mean, how lucky could we be?
Oh, this is great. We're having a great time. I love the ride. You know, we get to travel across the country, get to see all these people, meet all these, you know, and see locations that we've never seen before. So, yeah, I just love it. Love it. I love road trips. I love meeting people. I love having a good time. And, you know, and like I said, almost everybody that we've met, I would say 99.9% of the people that we've met have treated us like as family. So when we meet them, you know, it's hugs and how you doing, and we sit down, and it's just like seeing old, you know, your old family members. So it's great.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. It's never a dull moment. It's always really, really interesting, and everybody's been really, really friendly on what we've done. And, you know, as far as education is concerned, you know, it goes just beyond what we're doing here. We do the expos, and we're always plugging the expos. You know, we're also honored to work with, like we mentioned earlier, Dave Duffy, who owns and runs with his daughter and his family Backwoods Home Magazine. And, you know, if you guys are just getting into prepping, or you're a prepper and you just like to find more information about what other people are doing, you know, picking up this magazine and the books that they have are just almost a mainstay. I mean, I constantly am doing this stuff. And looking inside the magazines and trying to learn new things. And the articles are always really, really good. I mean, unfortunately, Dave is a little bit picky grammatically. You know, so when we submit things to him or even write him an email, we get corrected. So I feel like I'm back in grade school. So not only is it kind of funny to have Dave and Annie and Lisa and the staff over there who are all wonderful, you know, say, hey, you misspelled something on your website or you did something like this on Facebook, and I feel a little bit silly. It also points out how bad the U.S. education system is, because I made it through and I still misspell things and have my bad punctuation. So thank you, Dave and crew, for correcting me and not making me look like too much of an idiot, and bad school system for letting me look like this. So, but an interesting thing that Backwoods Home Magazine is doing that I never noticed before, and I wanted to talk to you about, Colorado. Did you know that you could buy the magazine with silver coins?
Ooh, very cool. I did not know that.
I pop up on their forums. They were gracious enough to give me permission to be on their forums, and I say that because, you know, nobody gives me permission to be anywhere. But anyway, I go to the forums, and I go to the page, and for the first time I noticed subscriptions for silver. And, they, you know, they basically say, here's your thing. You get a one-year subscription for $1 in junk silver or one silver dollar. So if you had a silver dollar, you send it to them, you get a one-year subscription. And then they break it down to two-year, three-year. It's like you get 3 years for two silver dollars. And
very cool.
And for a lot of people in this community, you know, they don't want to be using credit cards. They don't want to be doing things like that. And so for them, you know, being able to do this, and it says, you know, hey, just take advantage of the offer right now. Send your coins. You send it to Backwoods Home Magazine, the P.O. Box, Gold Beach, Oregon. And it says, just put on a note that Dave's Silver Coin offer, and they'll get you a subscription. And we were talking about with Alan about, you know, making sure we educate people in the ways to get out to it. And we were talking to Jackie about her classes and why she did it. God bless Dave and his family for going ahead and doing something like this that gives people an opportunity to, if they're a little bit worried or break out of the system, for them to be able to get the education and do something like this without people having to have a credit card or jump on a computer and do a PayPal account.
Absolutely. You know, and it was, you know, what was cool about that too is I remember that people were asking him at our expo if they could pay in silver. And so he had no problem with it, of course, and was selling books with silver coins. So I thought that was cool. I didn't realize that he was taking it to the next level and actually doing it, you know, through the subscription base. So that's awesome.
Yeah. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Dave and Annie and kind of throw it out there, and also I want to give a shout out to Sam, because Sam is the one that I think is helping transform Backwoods Home Magazine from paper to the techno geeks like me who can get it on their Kindle and their iPad, which is a huge cool. Although I would recommend to everybody do that subscription, but get your paper also, because it's not going to do you any good to go ahead and try to find how to take care of medicinal uses with garlic or affordable firearms and things like that if there's no power. It's a power grid now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
I recommend
hey,
both.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Definitely. If you can do both, hey, and we now know it's two silver dollars. Hey, that's easy. Come on. We can do that. So we are going to be talking to Mad Mike here in a few minutes. I hear that he's on a satellite phone. He's probably somewhere roaming the world. I'm sure that's not true. I mean, he probably is on a sat phone. Mad Mike does a lot of traveling and everything else, and we appreciate that he pops out. And as soon as we can get him on, we'll go ahead and get started on his stuff. But let's go back to our trip. So we're here. At the Popular Mechanics Show, and we just came back from deciding that we are doing an East Coast show. So what we can officially tell you is our remaining shows for this year are going to be one on the East Coast in North Carolina. I think we can state that we will be doing North Carolina. Is that correct?
Yep.
And then we have our May event, which is Colorado Springs, and then we have October, which is Mesa, Arizona. And what are the dates of the Mesa, Arizona show?
I knew you were going to say that. I believe it's October 26th, 27th.
Yeah, and see, because I knew that he would say, I knew you were going to say that, I think that they're October 26th and 27th, I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt it is October 26th and 27th.
Why do you do that to me?
Because I'm the ugly one and the one that gets bashed upside the head with the frying pan, and you're the one that actually forgets things, and I get to go to you and say, hey, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, are you ready for the show? And you're like, ugh. It's a beautiful marriage. Yeah. Otherwise, if you've never seen Colorado Ron and look at our Facebook, he's a big strapping guy with a beard, and he's a good-looking, friendly, jovial sort of person and everything else. And so I have nothing to make fun of him about. You know, it's like, so if I wasn't able to make fun of his lack of memory, you know, it's like, hey, who is that over there? What's their name again? He's like, oh, man, and I know what their name is. I just like watching them struggle for 5 minutes and trying to figure out what their name is.
Now I know your game. All right.
Come on, that's all I've got. All right, so Before we lose them, let's go ahead and get Mad Mike on the phone. I was told that he's on there. Mad Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am, Bubba, and good morning there, Colorado. How are you guys doing?
Doing good.
We're doing really good. Where are you at in the world today?
Oh, I'm in drizzly. I wish it was sunny, but San Diego. And it's actually a nice change in the weather, because now we're back to some sort of normalcy, let's put it that way. It's, drizzling in springtime, and it's kind of slow, and I'm enjoying listening to you guys on Saturday morning.
Well, thank you very much. So this is kind of like my confession box. You know, every week I like to throw out a new confession and everything else, and so I'm going to throw this out to the world. About 3 weeks ago, after we had Mike on an episode, he said, "Hey, I think I want to take on a personality. I want to take on the Mad Mike, moniker." And I go, "Oh, okay." And I got all excited about it. So the next two episodes, I announced that, "Hey, we're going to have Mad Mike here. And then when he got on the show, I called him Mad Mike. And then he sent me an email later going, "I was kidding."
Well, it's actually true, Bubba, is that when we were talking on the phone, when I first mentioned, that moniker, Mad Mike, I was having a bad day, and it's been a long struggle since Fukushima, trying to educate and bring the awareness of, radioactive fallout to everybody. And I just having a bad day, and I just, was frustrated with all the misrepresentation of the news and, the hidden reality of what's going on all around us. And hey, I thought, because of just listening, and I actually, just to start off on this, just to give you an idea of what I have to deal with every day, I have hanging here a cast iron pot, and I also have in my hand a wooden spoon. My mother raised six kids, and luckily, Bubba, she never hit us with the cast iron pan, but she did catch us with that wooden spoon all the time. And so what I'm going to do right now is take my wooden spoon and hit that cast iron pan. And you guys, hopefully you heard that.
I heard it, yeah.
You heard it. Well, the reason why I did that is that the problem with this radiation is that it's basically human psychology. And what I have had to battle is the whole perception of radiation and fallout and let's say a nuclear disaster is so far out of our reality that the first thing that a human being does is go into denial, basically, or just shut it off. They'll glaze over if you start talking to them, and actually it's the conscious mind not being able to digest or really look at it at face value. And so it does go into the subconscious. But what I'm going to do every once in a while, if I come across a special point, and I actually hope that some of the kids out there might get out a wooden spoon and a cast iron pan, and when they see the adults glazing over or going into denial about radiation, maybe they can hit that cast iron pan to kind of shake up the adults in their audience. So I sent you a map that I put together because you had asked me about the power plants in our country.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you'd like, I would like to, I've got a whole list of things to say, but I was hoping that you guys could actually prompt me. So when you look at that map, what did it make you think?
I thought,
I'm glad I'm not in the red.
I'll tell you what, I said it earlier, Mike. I actually led off the hour. Colorado Ron hadn't come on yet, and I told people about this map, and I'm putting it up on Facebook right now. And I was saying I was completely wrong, and I was shocked about where the areas you should be worried about compared to where the map actually shows things.
And right.
The coverage is amazing, especially on the East Coast.
Yeah, and basically for your audience, all I did was take a map of the United States, and it shows all the nuclear power plants and actually nuclear weapons depots and I would imagine laboratories. But I only really focused on the power plants. And as Scott Bubba was saying, that when you look at just the traditional evacuation zones, which I covered in red, you see that the eastern third of the United States, actually from the Dakotas to the east, so almost half of the eastern side of the United States, is pretty much covered if all of the plants were to have a problem at the same time. And that's the first point about the map, is that when you look at, you know, how it's covered on the West Coast a little bit, and then, you know, traditionally the Midwest and the, I should say, the around the Rockies and Montana and Wyoming, that's, you know, fairly clear. But these are all assuming that the traditional evacuation zones of, you know, up to 75 miles away from a plant, let's say, and even though they start off with 25 kilometers or, you know, 18 miles away. But this is only showing traditional. It's not showing the wind patterns. It's actually, you know, it's assuming in the old school that the wind patterns are normal. And one thing I didn't want to mention is that Fukushima is a long ways away from us. And the fallout hit the West Coast kind of hard, but then it also hit St. Louis. And I would imagine, you know, depending on the jet stream, other places in between. And, you know, it showed up, plutonium showed up in Boston. So the idea that this map is showing the immediate, let's say, evac areas, it's not really giving us the idea of what we know today, is that one plant going off in Florida probably will affect Europe more than it'll affect, you know, let's say, the West Coast of the United States, based on the prevailing winds and the jet streams. But, yeah, it's a big but. So anyway, I think I would like to, because no one can see these maps, I just wanted to mention, all nuclear power plants are very complex. We all know that. I think a nuclear-powered submarine might be a little, you know, might be on the high end of that. But the idea is that all power plants need to cool. I mean, the way that, you know, they run is taking the heat of that reaction and then creating steam, or actually creating steam and running generators. But the whole thing is controlled by cooling. Every single power plant has to have a river, an ocean, some kind of water source that it's used to, you know, to cool. You stop that water source for whatever reason, flooding, lack of power, earthquake, tornado, hurricane, you know, any reason, any plant, we're in serious trouble. And so what I wanted to say to you and everybody is that, yeah, one plant might have a problem. The natural disaster in Fukushima, it took out, you know, the three of them are in meltdown. We think maybe a fourth is in meltdown out of the sixth at Daiichi, but then there's two other locations that they're not talking about that have potential meltdowns going on too. So what I think I'm trying to get at in this discussion is that no matter where we live, the potential for a Fukushima-like event is very high based on natural disasters. Now, if you look at, you know,
That's a little concerning, Mike.
It's a little concerning. It's actually, that's why I say, you know, it's one of those things that we don't know how to deal with, even on at face value, so we turn it off. And that's really, and it's unfortunately, the governments, and I'm going to tacitly say that the medical industry, they know the immense problem that we have, and they also know that it's real easy to sidetrack us and to put us to sleep and make us, you know, not worry about this, because it's something that we really can't deal with. Now, I wanted to put a picture in everybody's mind, hopefully. You might think of a movie you've seen. Now, there's many that I think I've seen in the past that show a high-speed crash. You know, let's say in Patriot, Harrison Ford's wife crashes on the freeway with a daughter. And they hit the crash cushions, and you see all the, you know, crash cushions flying and the water flying, covering, you know, and that's really what keeps people alive, those crash cushions, you know, because they absorb the energy. Okay, now hopefully everybody's seen that. Have you seen that, Colorado, in any movies?
Oh,
how, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, here we're looking at, now I'm going to switch back to, you know, the nuclear reactors. When we had the solar flares, we just had a few of them, you know, in the past couple of weeks. But when I searched through all the incident reports from the NRC in the past 2 months, let's say, actually it started in January for this report, a lot of the incident reports or problems that, you know, caused a filing, problems at a nuclear power plant in this country, are switching and sensors and a lot of electrical slash mechanical instrumentation is failing or they're having problems with. And what I'd like to suggest is that they're not connecting it to the solar flares, but San Onofre, you know, had a number of major problems, but it was instigated by an overload in the power supply, the power lines. There was a spike that shut it down. That basically that hot shutdown caused the retirement of two nuclear power plants. We're not too sure why yet, at least it hasn't been released to us. But one of the reasons why I want to say the crash cushions, or why I wanted to, you know, put that in everybody's, hopefully, a picture in their mind. I've mentioned before, I'm an engineer, built a lot of bridges, done a lot of plans for roadways, and around every construction site on a road, and you guys, that's where we see these crash cushions put up temporarily. I've done plans for thousands of them. Never once, ever, have I ever seen a crash cushion filled with water. They're always filled with sand. And if you think about it, it's a plastic barrel, and if there was a crack, that water would empty out, let's say, if there was, or it could freeze, or. And so what I'm trying to say is that here, most of the people that I've ever come in contact think, or come in contact with, and bring this up, think that those crash cushions are filled with water, only because the TV told them, showed them. That's what they think. Now, and it's totally wrong. There are none. And so the reason why I said that is that the nuclear power plant problem that we have is a technology that is aging. They have great new technology in reactors, and when I say great, I'm going to put that in quotes because I don't think they're really necessary for producing electricity today, except for the fact that the long interim between changing technologies. I mean, we're kind of stuck with them for the moment. But the idea is that, remember that the news is telling you the crash cushions are full of water, and they're not. They're full of sand. And same thing with the reactors and all their problems. And so you asked me, basically the map just says if you live on the East Coast, you have a potential for acute radiation. If there was ever a problem close by to you at the plant, you have a potential of moderate and, let's say, minor radiation in the whole half of, you know, eastern seaboard, if a plant or two were to go. On the West Coast, you have, I think there's only three locations that I show. But, you know, that's just showing nuclear power plants and fallout, and it's really not adding the high probability or the potential for volcanoes and eruptions. And that's one of the reasons why, as a prepper or as a, you know, looking for relocation, a lot of people won't pick, let's say, Northern California, Southern Oregon, or Nevada, Utah area, and they'll go just a little farther east. And so realistically, Bubba and Ron, you guys are kind of living in the right area, aren't you?
Well, I think he is.
Well, I looked, Bubba. You're not so far. You know, I mean, you're right at the borderline, kind of a potential fallout. But
where do you consider the safest places? Looking at that map and knowing what you know, where do you consider some of the safest places in the country? Just out of curiosity.
In the country, Probably. that's such a tough one. See, you know, I have my property right near Colorado, and I got a couple hundred acres, and I followed what the government thought was one of the safest locations and where they opted to move a lot of their resources, which is, you know, east of Denver there. I wanted to move to Montana, up near, you know, Big Fork and stuff. And so I think pretty much anywhere within the Rocky Mountains, you know, either side. Unfortunately, the western slopes have a lot of, and I didn't mention that about Nevada, all the previous nuclear bomb testing, and, you know, there's still a lot of fallout. I just heard a gentleman who has leukemia that he's actually a, how do I say that? He talks a lot about fallout. Just leave it at that. But he did say that the numbers, you know, he did, because he lives in Salt Lake, he was really up on the higher leukemia and the higher cancer rates based on just that testing. So anyway, back to it, it's really the Rocky Mountains close to them within, you know, that few hundred miles. Now, it could stretch all the way to the Dakotas, even though you know, as you were talking earlier in the show, you really want to pick an area that has water, so you don't need, you know, 400 acres per cow. And, you know, so, but to tell you the truth, this situation is, there really isn't any safe place. The only thing that we're really talking about is, is someone going to knock on your door and say it's time to leave? And you got to just, as they did in Japan, you got to just leave everything. And that's one of the better aspects of being in the heartland, let's say, or east of the Rockies or in the Rockies, is that they most likely won't knock on your door. They'll probably be knocking on your door to come in and hopefully, you know, survive with you with all of the tools that hopefully we can talk about a few things on how to mitigate at least today, and then we can, you know, hopefully tomorrow if things got worse, there'll be, you know, other tools that we can use.
Well, let me hit you with some specific questions, Mike. So, I mean, you know, when you look at natural disasters and you look at things and you look at this map that you sent us, which is like, oh my God, scary. What if you were to put a rating of, let's say, 1 to 10 on the areas that would that are more likely, being a structural engineer, to have a Fukushima sort of incident? Because I'm looking at this and we've got California. That's got some, you know, got some pretty serious red on here. We've got, you know, you've got the East Coast. You've even got Florida. For those of you who live in Florida, you ain't safe. You know, you look at this. Is earthquake more detrimental to, or worse than, you know, like hurricanes, which would be, I guess, Florida? I guess you have a potential tsunami on either side. And what's, you know, when we're looking at this, it's like, which ones are in really the hazard zones? I mean, that are more likely going to happen. I mean, I would say California has got to be one of them, you know, with as many earthquakes as y'all have.
Yes, and that's really the point. You mentioned hurricanes, and when you said that, you know, each time I hear that, what goes through my mind is, my gosh, I've been living through decades and decades, you know, hearing about hurricanes. You know, hitting either from the Gulf or on the eastern seaboard, and I've never over the past few decades heard of power plants, you know, melting down. So really, as I said before, the only problem with the flooding and the hurricanes per se in the past has been a prolonged shutdown so that the backup power you know, run or fails. Let's say the main power lines are down and they can't get power in. So when you ask that question in a 1 to 10, it's really hard because, again, all you have to do is, for some, any reason, shut down the cooling. And that's, you know, one of the problems with our planet today with Fukushima is there to keep those corariums and to keep the ones that haven't melted down from melting down. They're dumping all the seawater on just to keep them cool, which is, you know, polluting the seawater and the oceans. But the idea is that I think when I look at the wind patterns, the changes in the jet stream, and I'm particularly concerned about, you know, the solar cycle we're in, because we're ramping up into the, you know, towards the maximum, which seems like it might be a year or two delayed. And just from the minor flares that we've seen, the plants are, they're just, what happens with the solar flare is that when we get those, you know, the highly energized particles to energize our atmosphere, we end up with a lot of ground currents, and that's when the switching and, you know, we get a lot of, transient currents that you can't test for, and they really don't know how to protect. I mean, you start blowing diodes out, all you can do is just put new diodes in if you got them on the shelf. If you don't have them, you know, you're... So 1 to 10, realistically, I would say today, all of them, because they're all subject to water, and whether it's sitting on an earthquake fault, and we're sitting in a time when we're having about a factor of 100. If you look 10 years ago and you look today, we have 100 times more powerful, or, you know, large earthquakes than we did a decade ago. I mean, and that's, you know, that should right there wake up people. Where's my wooden spoon? When you look at that, and then you think last year we had all the flooding, and we had a couple plants that were completely flooded, and they, you know, sandbagged them and airbagged them, and, you know, they were doing the best they could. But let's say that the flooding that we get in the future, one of the plants might not make it through. So the idea is that if you look at what's going on today, we're all at risk, and basically because the technology, the plants, we have 23 of the same Mark I reactors as the ones in Fukushima that are melting down today, and those are the ones that have the spent fuel pool ponds and storage above the reactor, which is, you know, they came to find out that's not a really good idea, even though it was easy to transport the rods from the reactor into the pool because it's right there. But what we have is that out of the 104, 105 plants, those are 23 of them that are just, earthquake. Again, I hate to say tsunami, but, we've had tsunamis before. I had a boat up in Alaska, and there was a line in the trees in a fjord that showed the last tsunami that came through, and it was, 240 feet up on, and it, you know, it took everything, just all the soil, all the trees off the rock, and you can see, and that happened, at the turn of the last century. But when you looked at that and you went, my gosh, I mean, this wave was, you know, that big to scour that. Now, that was in a fjord. But the idea is that, again, the sun is doing some very strange things. You might not know, but we've had every week comets, at least one, hit the sun coming from the south. There's a whole entourage of objects, including what some think is a large dwarf star coming in. Which is, very cyclical. Last month, the month before, one of the comets was larger than Mercury, probably the size of Venus, even though that wasn't really exposed through mainstream media. Again, it's the water and the crash cushions. But if you have an object as large as Venus coming in and, you know, slamming into the sun, and these are happening, not that large, but these comets are, you know, coming in and encountering at least once a week, that's suggesting that our weather, the solar flares, and let's say the ground currents, or we've all heard about CME coming in the 1800s telegraph lines, transferring the high voltage, and then fire starting at the actual instruments. ground currents are one thing, but then you have all these power lines which could be sending other currents through that knock out the switching there. So then, you know, you lose that main power. With the ground currents, you have your backup diesels. And what I'm trying to do is say that we have a technology that really is old, and it really doesn't suit or fit the upcoming near future. And we can expect to see more problems. Fukushima has shown us that we don't know how to deal with this problem because they
Let me jump in here, Mike. So
yes.
let's connect some very basic dots. So I mean, I think this is, you know, we talked about this before. It's like when we're convincing the audience, not that we're here to convince you guys, we're here to give you the education and let you make your own decision. But you know, let's try to connect some very simple dots for people and see where kind of goes. So I think everybody out there would state that although a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, the government and the mainstream media was playing down solar flares. You know, these things aren't that big, and yes, they happen, but they happen all the time. And now NASA and all the organizations, they can't hide them anymore. And so they're out there saying, yes, they're here, yes, they're huge, but believe it, yeah, they're not really affecting anything, and you know, it's minor, and we've got control over it. You know, we should, as careful people, assume that that's not necessarily the case. They're not giving us the full story. That being said, if that is true, you're saying that these solar flares have the capability, because some of our systems, let's just deal with the United States, here are antiquated, and that we have, we've all been led to believe, which I kind of believe is kind of leading us down the rabbit hole, was the thing that we needed to be concerned about, these things blowing up and everything else. There's really a bigger concern is these things shutting down because of EMP or problems from solar flares, or even a natural disaster who shuts it down. And the things we should be concerned about is, A, the fallout that goes up in the air and gets spread across the United States, but B, potential contamination of the groundwater because of the purging of the cooling systems. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes, and actually you just brought up a really a good point, is that watching what they're doing with the seawater in Japan, and now let's go to the Missouri River, the Mississippi, or you know, one of the plants, Calhoun, or let's say they had, you know, they had a problem, and the only way to keep it from running away into a meltdown and possibly an explosive situation is just continue to dump that river water on. And you can't contain it. So where's it going? It's going downriver. And that's a problem that, you know, it's something, again, that you can't prepare for something like that. Or you couldn't be in business. Already, unfortunately, the nuclear power industry has never made a dime. We've only spent money on it. It costs a lot more to make electricity out of nuclear power. Its benefits are other things, which is medical and military. That's why we have it, basically, or that's why we fund it. So, yes, the idea is that there's a number of things. And when you said, I don't know if I said antiquated, but they're very old. And what I meant was they're old, and which means that their parts are worn out. And if you have a problem with, let's say, a ground current and it fries a big quick disconnect and all the diodes fry, or the, you know, quick, I'm not sure the right term, if they're slow blow fuses or whatever, but the fuses blow. Well, you have to have those sitting, you know, in on site if you want to repair it right away. And what they found with the CME studies is that just our grid, you know, the transformers that we'll lose if a CME were to, you know, hit us directly, a strong one, the transformers that'll blow are not available, and the best estimate was 3 years to get them back, you know, at least down at the bottom of the pole, not even put on the pole, or in the, let's say, the substations. These problems, and I just use that as, you know, that's the grid. But as far as the nuclear power plants, again, Fukushima has shown us we don't know what we're doing. We don't have any solutions. We can't stop the problem that they have over there. And Just as an update for Fukushima, there's no new serious news, except the government, because there's so much I mentioned last time about the evacuation potentially of Tokyo, and how now you have millions of people worried, what, when, and where they're going to go. Well, the government came out because there's so many questions on where do we move, on Honshu, or where do we move in Japan that's safe. And the government came out and they said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to ship all the contaminated, or we're going to ship the contaminated materials to all the municipalities on Honshu to be burnt. So now everybody can share in the pain. They'll all have fallout. So that now, you won't have all the Japanese from one area trying to move to another area. So anyway, so the reason why I said that is that's their government, how they're solving a problem. They're just going to spread it around, that keeps
Right. Well, let me keep going down that rabbit hole, Mike. Which is, all right. So if you said I was basically correct, and one of the things that Fukushima has shown us, and one of the things we have to be concerned about, is like the purging of the tanks and all the things that are getting in, not only the air but the water system. I have to play devil's advocate here. Surely, if they're using the Mississippi or the Arkansas or Snake River, any of these things to purge this stuff, there can't be, those tanks aren't that big. The capacity is not that large. The parts per million or the parts for each gallon of water that gets rushed down those things, surely by the time it gets all the way through, it can't still be that detrimental. I mean, obviously the buildup over time can be bad, but is it really that hazardous the second it goes out there? Are we being fooled by thinking that it's not that, it's that bad?
I might be confused. So I'm going to attack it in two different directions. One is that all power plants have an intake and outtake, the cooling water, and they all release minor radionuclides, whether it's in the water. I really shouldn't say so much in the water, but yes, you can actually detect nuclides on the outtakes. Here in San Onofre, there are pictures of giant clams and giant mussels. I'm not sure the exact name of the species, but because of the radiation, they've had some pretty large. Strange-looking sea life around the tubes, or around the intakes and the outtake. But the idea is that what I was saying was, let's say you had a problem that similar to Fukushima. Let's say there's an earthquake on the New Madrid Fault, and one of the plants really gets shaken up, and it's starting to we lost the main cooling for some reason, or the main power, but it's really the cooling. Let's say the earthquake ruptured the backup line and the main line so that we couldn't get water in there. Well, the only thing they could do is like they're doing in Fukushima, which is stick a suction pump into the river basically and just pour river water on that reactor and trying to keep water in it to keep it cool so it doesn't melt down. And that's what I was saying. So only if there's a problem they will throw water on that and try to contain it just like they did in Fukushima. But once you run out of, storage vats or, storage tanks, you have to dump it back into the river. And what I'm trying to say is that in order to keep a meltdown from happening, they're going to dump that in the river, and basically not tell us. They just have to do it. There are so few solutions once these things get out of hand. San Onofre almost got out of hand. We were lucky in the fact that they were able to not put it into back, I think, 100% full operation. And when they found out, it wasn't a problem to go into to get it into cold shutdown, let's say, even though they went into a hot shutdown originally last summer. But here's the thing, that before we run out of time, because it always it always happens.
Yeah.
I was just going to say
we're down to 5 minutes, so let's...
Okay, 5 minutes. Here, I got to say a disclaimer first. These are I'm going to call solutions, and they're really they're just part of a cornucopia of things that we should be doing in a radionuclide environment, at least, you know, starting to learn and adapt. And the disclaimer is, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a health professional, or a medical professional, I'm an engineer. I had to learn this area because I found it was lacking, and this is before Fukushima, and there's reasons why I was pushed into this, you know, into this area. But after saying that, what we have is we have from Fukushima today, and what we've been talking about is potentially tomorrow from our own plants, radionuclides in the air, in the water, and in the food. And it's in a minor concentration here, even though the longer the radionuclides with longer half lives like cesium and strontium, they are accumulating. They're not just going away. The iodine that all the kids got here, there was a study that was released last week, I believe, but it was a transcript from an audio or a conference call from a few government agencies back in May. And it talked about, there was a study done the first week after plant one. They just used Fukushima plant one, not plant three, which was the bad one. But when plant one blew, they did a study or a model, and they figured that a child 1 year old here in Southern California, from that one blast, and they only used the 1 week that it, you know, blew out into the atmosphere, the child got about 80% of what would be an acute dose of radioactive iodine. So every one-year-old child, and it's a really funny, it's an odd way that the report and the verbiage was, because it didn't really make sense because they were using long-term years and things. But what I'm trying to say is that the one power plant in Japan did affect us here. Now, the air, food, and water, the first thing that I want to say is greenhouses. Greenhouses. Colorado's building one or has built one. We start growing our food in an environment that, even if we don't have the right air filter in the greenhouse right now, because there aren't any, you know, for radiation, even though I'm sure there are people working on it. But if you have the greenhouse, it means when it rains, you're not dropping radionuclides directly on your plants or into the soil, and that's actually the worst thing, is all this stuff getting in the soil, and then the plants uptake it, and then we eat it, or the cattle eat it, and they accumulate it, bioaccumulate it, and then we, you know, we eat the cattle. And so the idea for any kind of radiation and air is, people have been having some luck with HEPA filters. It pulls out some. So if you have, you know, a good, you know, you change out your filters, in, you know, this is for your house, let's say, and, you know, if you have central or forced air, or just buy a standalone HEPA filter from Sears or something. When it rains, again, assume that some of those raindrops have radionuclides in it. The water, and this is the greatest thing about us and the Self-Reliance Expo, water is a real problem because there aren't methods that pull out most of the radionuclides in municipal water, or if you're on well water, what do you do? Well, the AquaPails, which is one of the vendors that we have at the Expo, it's a brand new zeolite-based water filtration system, and all it is the different sizes are buckets. But the zeolite, it turns out, is one of the key minerals that, based on its structure and how it works, it sequesters certain radionuclides, and especially cesium and strontium. And so as far as water, first thing is AquaPails, and then down the road, hopefully, there will be either a different other versions of AquaPails will come out with other let's say, solutions to, instead of just the grab and go. See, the Aquapail was designed for, let's say, a disaster like Haiti or, you know, an earthquake or whatever.
Yeah. And in a bucket system, so you can grab it, right?
Right. But the idea is that the zeolite in the Aquapail is the key. And there's a few companies out there that sell zeolite. I have tons of it stockpiled in Colorado, and I just got the test reports on Friday, the first batch of test reports before I can, you know, I have to do a few more before I'm going to bring it to market. But the idea is that just want to let everybody know this zeolite is amazing because, and I'm going to jump real quick because we're almost out of time.
Actually, we have like 1 minute left, so we need to wrap it up.
Okay. What I want to say is there are very few drugs, RX, see your MD doctor, that's only for acute. Really look into zeolite, clays, the turmeric, really, there's a number of things that help, but, oh gosh, we're out of time. And all I want to,
Here's what we're going to do, folks, is next week we'll bring Mad Mike on for the first 10 minutes and try to get going over the products and the recommendations that he has to get this done. So if you can condense your thoughts for next week, Mad Mike, on specifically on getting this information out, I think that'll help. I mean, unfortunately, these things – With all these sessions, we went up to 3 hours because we thought we'd have enough time to do things, but we never have enough time for the topics. They could go on forever. So are you available next Saturday to hop on for us for another 10 minutes, Mike?
Sure.
Okay.
That'd be great.
All right, guys.
Okay.
Colorado.
You guys have a good week, you guys. Thank you very much.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon. All right, guys. Back with Hill Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed. Thank you guys for joining us. I'm going to go down there and join Colorado Ron, the madman, out there at the expo. How's it looking?
Looking good. Nice crowd.
Okay, can you sneak me in the door, or am I going to have to pay?
You got to pay.
I figure. See, once again, no love for the Bubba. No love for the Bubba. Anyway, guys, hey, we're proud to bring you this show every week, Self-Reliance Exposed by Backwoods Home Magazine, every Saturday, 7 a.m. to the big 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings. We'll be hitting you guys with more information. We'll be posting up who our guests are for next week. Please visit www.selfreliance expo to get more information about the expos that we have coming up. Visit our Facebook page, which is the Self-Reliance Expo, and also visit our good friends and partners at Backwoods Home Magazine at www.backwoodshome.com. This is Bubba DaVinci and Colorado Ron signing off, and we will see you in 7 days.
You've been listening to BHM Radio, the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine on the Preparedness Radio Network. Tune in every other week at this time to get more information on the articles you love. Questions or comments for the hosts? Email them at coloradoron@gmail.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives. Discover the taste of the sun. Thousands of preppers have acquired a sun oven to have on hand in the event of an emergency and have been pleasantly surprised by the improved taste of sun-cooked foods. Sun ovens are a preparedness item you can start using today. A sun oven will pay for itself by reducing your utility bills and by keeping your house cooler in the summer. Food can be baked, boiled, or steamed at temperatures of 360 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit with the power of the sun. Sun ovens are often confused with homemade solar cookers, but they get considerably hotter, cook food faster, and hold temperatures longer. Sun ovens fold up in seconds, carry like a suitcase, and have many innovative features which make them the ultimate solar appliance. For the past 25 years, sun ovens have been proudly made in the U.S. They are durable and have a long life and come with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. For a discount coupon, email preppers@sunoven.com. That's preppers@sunoven.com.
It's the 21st century, a dangerous world. Preppers need food and medicine. Why not have the best?
Enterfood.com does the shopping, prep, and packaging for you using the best organic ingredients on the planet. Right now, specials are available for listeners of this station. The all-organic vegetarian food storage pail and the herbal medicine cabinet. The pail holds up to 120 flavorful meals, super packed fresh to last up to 15 years, soaked, cooked, or raw. The herbal medicine cabinet holds everything you'll need to cure common ailments. Use these items in an emergency or use them when camping. You can't beat these prices. Call to order now. 866-762-9238. 866-762-9238 or go to enerfood.com. That's E-N-E-R-F-O-O-D.com. Enerfood.com.
You've been listening to the Preparedness Radio Network, offering helpful and timely tips on preparing for natural and man-made disasters. Timely and useful tips on gardening and homesteading. Check us out online at BePreparedRadio.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.